You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows at castaway.media or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/castawaypodcasts.
Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of Retro Asylum. I'm Matt Lamborn, aka Nets, and I'm joined by a very special guest this week, my best friend and cohort, Mr. Matthew Aguilera. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, it's great to be on here, actually, talk about something that is very, very important to the both of us.
It is. It's a massive part of our gaming heritage, isn't it, in history in general, and probably played a small part in how we actually came into being friends in the first place, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. So as you've probably noticed, listeners, this is an episode dedicated to the 25th anniversary of Street Fighter II, one of the most important and best games of all time. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the history of Street Fighter II in terms of how it came to be in the arcade, some of the games preceding it, how it came to be, and then the lasting legacy that the game has had on the industry ever since. So before we get into that, though, I just want to talk a little bit more about Matt's history, because this is your first time on the show, Matt, and people won't be quite as familiar with your gaming history as perhaps some of the other hosts of Retro Asylum. So just tell us a little bit about yourself, your gaming history, and how much Street Fighter 2 means to you.
Okay, I'll try and do as much justice as I can for myself and also for Street Fighter because it deserves it. My history goes back to, I started playing on the Atari 2600 when I was a kid, about 3 or 4. I had an Amstrad CPC 464, and then my very own console that was bought for me on my birthday was a Master System. And that's when it really took a hold of me, and I started to really love games as a form of entertainment. When other people were reading books and watching movies, I wasn't really that interested. I just wanted to discover more games on the Master System. And from that, it became this integral hobby for the rest of my life, and I went through all the systems, of course, you know, and I could reel them all off. But the most important thing is that when we come to the Mega Drive and Super Nintendo era, that's when these import games came along. And because me and you are both from the same town, luckily we had this insight into import gaming that was nationwide. A company called Console Concepts, they were sending off review copies to various magazines that we used to read. And so we were ingrained in this community of people that were playing games before they came out over here. And it was just such a goddamn interesting time. But the pinnacle of that absolutely is the Super Famicom or Nintendo, the Japanese version of Street Fighter 2 coming out. And that really changed the way that we looked at games, because it became such a big deal. And of course, it didn't come out for a very long time in Europe, and most people were playing it in the arcades, and we were lucky enough to have it first. So I hope that's summed up enough about what my gaming history is. And also, when it comes to Street Fighter, I can remember everything about when I first bought Street Fighter 2, believe it or not.
Go on, tell us a little bit about that then, because that's a very big story in itself, isn't it? Everyone's first time of getting hold of Street Fighter 2, it's one of those memories people don't tend to let go of, is that right?
Yeah, I would say so, because for me especially, the big thing is that it came out on the Super Famicom. We just had a Super Famicom. I've played Street Fighter 2 in the arcades. I loved it. I got on with the 6 buttons straight away. People were like saying how confusing it was, and I seemed to just take to it. Just to give you some context, I'm 7 at this point. And it was the first day, it was the first time that my older brother, who was 6 years older than me, or is 6 years older than me, should I say, he took me out to the town. It was just me and him together. So that was a special memory. And we went specifically to buy Street Fighter 2. And this is the very most interesting thing about Street Fighter 2 at this point on Japanese. It was £90 as an import. It was previously £100 and we couldn't get it before. And we'd saved the money together somehow. And we got £90 together and we went down to get it. And I can remember the whole thing being like, it was one of my favourite memories actually of my life, is going down to town with my brother, picking up Street Fighter 2, seeing the box, and the box art was amazing, the Japanese version. And then obviously the instructions were so interesting, even though they're written in Japanese and I couldn't understand a lick of it. There was so much detail and there was all these special moves and we could see the directions and the buttons, but we didn't know what they were. So there was this whole world to discover within Street Fighter. And from that moment, we came home. And I can remember that his friend across the road had come, some relative or something lived across the road from his friend. And his friend had come around to see him. And he literally wouldn't go to the door to him because we had Street Fighter 2. my mum called up and said, so-and-so's here. And he just went, turned around and just went, and? Honestly, it was amazing what this... It brought me and my brother closer together, which is a great thing. And obviously we were close. But then we just sat there, we started playing Street Fighter, and it was about as arcade perfect as you could expect at the time. It was amazing. And we sat down, we made our own paper charts of the special moves, writing them down, and we sat there and tried to master every character. And that's something that we did together, and wow. Yeah, just thinking about it now and thinking back to that time, it was obvious that we were part of something very, very special. To put it into some kind of context for retro events in my life that would be really special. So, again, Sonic the Hedgehog and the Mega Drive is one of them that preceded this. But Street Fighter 2 is one that I remember even better. So even for that memory by itself, without all the rest that comes with it, that's how much I love Street Fighter 2.
That's nicely summed up. I think I'm the same as you. I don't recall any other game having quite so much anticipation and excitement as a youngster, particularly as we'd been reading about it for months in magazines and it finally arrived. And if you read Me Machines or magazines of similar ilk at the time, it was very difficult for you to be expected to wait another 9 months or a year to get the PAL release. So this was probably the game that really rammed home the import scene, because as I recall, there was massive waiting lists for this game because Capcom couldn't churn them out quick enough. You know, it was one of those ones where they could have printed off millions and they would have still sold in the first few weeks. They were churning out hundreds of thousands in the first few months and people just couldn't get them out quick enough. Mm-hmm. So there was a big black market for Street Fighter 2. With these overpriced sales, like you mentioned, it being £90 to £100, which, you know, back then is a lot of money compared to what it would be now. It might be 150, 160 quid game, maybe. So we hadn't had a game like this that caused such a stir on the import scene, but everyone was clamoring to these import specialists like Console Concepts or Special Reserve, etc., who advertised a lot in the big magazines at the time. And they must have made their business on its own pretty much overnight. And then you have the rest of the scene sort of clamoring for shelf space around it. But it's such a monumental game in terms of what it did and for gaming in relation to what was coming over from Japan, because we were kind of muddled at that time. We were one foot in the sort of Western gaming scene and one foot in Japan, people who preferred Sega and Nintendo to the stuff that was going on the home computers in the UK and stuff. But this really brought Japanese gaming to the forefront worldwide. It's such an important title. But before we get into more detail about Street Fighter 2 specifically, let's have a little talk about the history that preceded it and how it came to being in the first place. And I think if we look back at some of the earlier fighting games, particularly on the home computers that were around at the time, that may have or may not have directly influenced Street Fighter 2. If we go back to sort of the mid to late 80s, your typical fighting game was a one-on-one affair with limited movesets, and it was always one playable character. So you're looking at stuff like international karate champ and waved the exploding fist, which would be quite familiar to most of our listeners. And they were all fine games in their own right, but not as technically proficient as something like Street Fighter eventually went on to being. And then, of course, Technos of Japan were doing really good side-scrolling games like Renegade and Double Dragon, which had a direct influence on stuff that Capcom were doing a little bit further down the line outside of Street Fighter 2. So when Capcom entered the foray in 1987 with the original Street Fighter, it was very different to what had been around at the time, wasn't it, Matt? If you want to just give us a little insight into your experiences with the original Street Fighter, which was released in late 1987, and it was developed by Takeshi Nishimura and Hiroshi Matsumoto, who they eventually go on to SNK, but again, we'll touch on that a little bit later. But what's your experience with the original Street Fighter?
Okay, well, you know, I'll give you a little bit, you know, things like International Karate Champ and IK Plus, those kind of that came out of the home computer. I remember them much more fondly than I do Street Fighter, just to put that out there. I think they were quite twee and quirky. Street Fighter, I remember being on the arcade, and I remember there being the pressure-sensitive buttons, and it didn't really stand out apart from the fact that it had this strange arcade cabinet with these strange buttons. And I used to believe that if you punched it really hard, that you'd make your character do a really powerful move. And that wasn't the case, of course. We know far better now. And I had Street Fighter on the Amstrad, and it was terrible. It's not a good game. It just isn't. I would defy anybody to say it's a good game apart from the fact that it had an interesting legacy beyond that. And it's part of one of the most important games that have ever graced our world. You know, Street Fighter, the first one, it's very poor. And that's from the arcade version down to the home computer versions. The one on the Amstrad was bloody terrible. And these conversions which were handled by US Gold, which didn't stand out. It just, the name stood out, if anything, if that makes sense. It was Street Fighter, so it sounded very interesting. And of course, at this time, I was playing things like Renegade and Double Dragon on the Amstrad and all the other kind of games that came out that time that were scrolling beat-em-ups. That was the thing that you looked out for. So Street Fighter brought this, what seemed to be a unique concept at the time, this 1v1, but the characters were barely memorable, and the graphics weren't great. And having reviewed it all again, especially in preparation for this podcast, it's amazing just how jerky, clunky, and very unsatisfying it is to play. And when you think that it made such an important sequel, it's amazing to think that this was its beginning, because its beginning is horrible.
Yeah, it's a stark difference, isn't it? And I think some people would perhaps disagree ever so slightly with our opinion overall of Street Fighter 1. Some people would say it was a good game for the time. At least on the arcade, the home conversions were all pretty poor. And you touched on US Gold doing the conversions, but they actually published the conversions, and they actually leased out the development of that to a different team called Tier Text.
Oh, right, okay.
If you recall, and they eventually went on to do Human Killing Machine as the unofficial sequel to Street Fighter.
Oh,
no. But they had a C64, Spectrum, Amstrad CPC, MS-DOS, Amiga, and Atari ST conversions, and they all got panned pretty badly. They just weren't capable of producing the game quick enough, or perhaps good-looking enough, to do justice to that particular arcade. So at home, this didn't stir anything whatsoever, did it? But arcade, it raised a few eyebrows, because it was quite novel in respect that it introduced the six-button control system, which is now pretty much standard, or at least it became standard a little bit later on. And most of the games at the time were using two or three buttons in terms of fighting games. So this was way out there, and perhaps a little bit intimidating, ever so slightly, to first-time players. So there are some innovations in Street Fighter, which are quite remarkable. So the six-button control system, the special moves, which was a big deal at the time.
Mm.
So there's a lot to sort of hold on to there, and it was definitely a step in the right direction. And in its own regard, it was actually quite successful in terms of turnover in the arcade, and people were clamoring for a sequel rather quickly. Which takes us on to the sort of next game in the Street Fighter 2 history, which is Final Fight. Now, I know you've got very fond memories of this one.
Oh, yes.
that, as we touched upon at the beginning of talking about Street Fighter, Nishimura and Matsumoto left Capcom. They went to SNK and they eventually work on Garou Densetsu, which was Fatal Fury in the West. Now, Capcom are desperate to get a sequel to build on the reasonable success of Street Fighter, and they have to get a whole new team in to do it. So production of the game went over to Yoshiki Okamoto, who'd already had a few hits under his belt. He had pedigree. He'd done some big games with Konami prior to joining Capcom, such as Time Pilot and Gyrus. And he had a successful, but very expensive, production run of Forgotten Worlds, which was one of the first, if not the first, I think, CPS arcade game for Capcom. And that's a great game in its own right. I love Forgotten Worlds.
Me too, yeah.
So one of his first points of call was to recruit Akira Yasuda to assist with the character design, and that was a masterstroke because he went on to work on all of Capcom's fighting games throughout the 90s. But because Capcom's sales division demanded that a new game came out as a Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter sequel, despite this particular game they're working on being more akin to Double Dragon, and the game that eventually started out as Street Fighter 89 eventually had the title dropped and became Final Fight. So tell us a little bit about your experience with Final Fight, Matt, because I know this is a big favourite for both of us.
Oh, yeah. Final Fight. So take in your mind Double Dragon, that was such a massive, massive hit, and it was one of those pinnacle of arcade games. It was up there with Space Invaders. If somebody didn't have an arcade cabinet with Space Invaders, they were very likely to have a cabinet that included Double Dragon or an off-spin like we were saying, like Renegade, and there's a few more that I can't remember by Konami that which were really, really good, called something like Gang Wars, something like that. So there was all these games, and then Final Fight came out, and not only did it have these spectacular graphics with these large sprites and this character select screen of characters that you really wanted to play with, like Hagar, Cody, and Guy, they all had something different about them, and they felt discernibly different when you controlled them. You had all these rich backgrounds, and the graphics were great, and the sound was great as well. And there was, it's a great game, Final Fight, and it was way in above beyond what was out there at the time. It's really hard to stress that now, reflecting on it. And the graphics and the sound, the graphics in particular, were so, so much better.
They were
than the
really,
competition.
Really good. I remember seeing this in the arcade and being used to, you know, very 8-bitty type games at the time. And like Double Dragon, which I pumped a lot of money into in the arcade, and then you see Final Fight, and it's like, wow, this is something from a different level, at least aesthetically, but gameplay-wise, it lived up and exceeded those older games as well anyway.
Yeah, it's like, for example, the animation was so much better than what we'd seen before. When you first saw Guy walk across the screen, and there's an exceptional amount of frames of animation, it really stood out for those kind of reasons. And you really wanted to kill the people that were involved in the game. Like, you really wanted to beat the shit out of them. And all the mechanics of it, so you could grab onto people and do power drivers with Hagar or Hagar. I don't know how you'd say it, but I've called him Hagar for so long. It's such a bad habit. It was one of those games that just eluded us for such a long time. It didn't come out on the home consoles for a very long time, and the versions that came out were terrible. And I include the SNES version in that one too. It was so, so, so surprising that they didn't capitalize on this. Every time I can remember, this is a really funny memory actually, it's just come to me. I can remember coming home one day from playing Final Fight on the arcades. I was walking home with my mum, and as I was walking home, I can remember crying. She's like, what's wrong with you? And I thought, I can't play Final Fight at home. I said, it's never going to happen. It's never going to come out. Weird. That's a weird memory, that is. but that shows how much of an experience it was to play that game. And I can remember soaking it all in when I used to play it. Like the second level where you go on the subway train, and how some of the people are sitting down, then they get up and then you'd fight them, and all the different weapons, which, you know, we haven't even touched on the weapons, for example. These are all things that were added in, and they were so much more grander and so much bigger and, well, more sexy, shall we say, than what Double Dragon was doing.
Yeah, because if you picked up a knife or a whip in Double Dragon, it was literally a few sprites. It didn't look good. It was just a mechanic. You had to use your imagination ever so slightly to get the full impact of it. But Final Fight, you were picking up massive katanas, massive lead pipes, big throwing knives, very detailed and very weighty. You know, you felt the impact of using them much more than you had done in these type of games that had come prior.
Yeah, and for example, like the samurai sword, it made a really satisfying swishing noise, like a when you cut people. And the sound helped to contribute to this experience. And I think one of the reasons why Final Fight was one of those games that I held on to so much and I love so much is obviously in its own right, it's a great game, but the home versions never came close. They were just when you think about what they did to the Super Nintendo. It's very early on in its life. It's a shame to see what came out, and this will be, some of the retro sound listeners will be thinking back to the Amiga and Atari ST versions, which the Amiga version actually looked quite good, but they just didn't handle very well. And I think that's indicative of the time, unfortunately. Just some conversions, they used a graphic palette that was taken from the arcade and everything else was kind of cobbled together behind it, which is a shame, really, because Final Fight was something that should have had a much greater legacy, and it does have one in its own right, but it's very strange to think that it's more of a niche than what Street Fighter is.
This is Nancy at Chase headquarters. We have an emergency here. Carlos, the New York armed robber, has been seen listening to Retro Asylum without leaving a review on iTunes. Over.
Leave it to us, Nancy, baby. Let's go, Mr. Driver.
If you really enjoy the Retro Asylum podcast show, then please leave us a review on iTunes.
We've had Street Fighter, or Fighting Street, on the PC Engine.
I was going to say, that's a strange one. It was called Fighting Street. I thought that maybe Fighting Street was a real name because the PC Engine was so great.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people probably thought that at the time, and because it wasn't so famous, they perhaps wouldn't have known any better. And then we have Final Fight, which, again, makes a very big splash in the arcades, and was by no means an underling in respect to what was going on at Capcom at the time. It was very much prime and center of what they were doing. But Okamoto and Yasuda return again, with finally delivering a true and genuine sequel to the original Street Fighter. And it goes without saying that the full release of Street Fighter II took the world by storm. You know, the game built on the innovations of the original even more so, had more selectable characters, because you could always play as Ryu in the original Street Fighter, of course. And it was the first time that it had multiple selectable characters in the fighting game, as well as the 8-way directional control to the tried and tested 6-button configuration that was successful in Street Fighter. And that allowed for a ton of gameplay and special move variation from that point on. It really opened up the full possibilities of what was attainable with a fighting game.
It really did. And one of the things I'll say is that when I first started to see Street Fighter 2 coverage pop up when it was in the arcades, I thought someone was taking the piss when they said it was good, because my previous experience with Street Fighter was that poor. I thought, it can't actually be good. You've got to be really hyping this up for no reason. But I think back to like CVG and Mean Machines. They used to talk about it all the time. There's always a section saying, oh, we've been playing Street Fighter 2. Oh, you should too. And there'd be coverage of the characters and all that. And, you know, Zangief and his big hairy chest thing that he had going on, and his massive arms, and how he was a slow character, but he was really strong. And I was like, it started to reel me in. But it's very interesting to see how much coverage they were giving to it. And they were talking about how they were having their own impromptu tournaments with their own arcade cabinets. And of course, back then you thought, what else could be better than writing about video games? And, you know, you took it for granted that they actually had a job. So you thought they just, you know, were standing around all day playing Street Fighter 2. And it made it so elite and so desirable and so aspirational for you to understand what Street Fighter 2 was, and also go and find an arcade cabinet that had it. That was the big thing. It was like, I've got to find out what this experience is all about.
Just for people who perhaps, let's say, are on the younger side of the retro scene and they perhaps weren't around for Street Fighter 2, or perhaps it just passed them by, what would you compare the sort of launch to Street Fighter 2 to anything else that's sort of happened in gaming history? Because it's really quite unprecedented how successful it was, and very quickly as well. It wasn't a slow-burning success like some of Capcom's later efforts. This was a smash beyond compare from day one, wasn't it?
It was. If I had to compare it for a younger audience, when it was in the arcades and you couldn't get access to it and you were trying to discover more about it, it was a bit like hearing about an indie game like you would now. So, for example, when Shovel Knight came out and that just exploded, or Super Meat Boy, you heard about it through word of mouth, and it was very exciting. But when it actually came to the game being released for the home versions, especially the NES, SNES version, my God, it was something like Pokemon or Grand Theft Auto 3. It was a massive, massive smash hit, and everybody was talking about it, and everybody had something to say about it, particularly at the playground or out there on the street. I remember my older brother, all of his friends, everybody had a skill move or a special character that they loved in Street Fighter, and it was that ingrained in people. It was an amazing time, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it really was, and I like the point that you made there about people getting attached to the identity of a certain character in Street Fighter 2, because I think once people got it at home, some people had taken the time to get to know all the characters and master them, but off the bat, you know, it's costing you money to play this game every time. You're putting 10p in the machine. You're probably going to lean to someone who immediately takes your eye, whether it's aesthetically or in their biographical history, which was something relatively new to a game. We've got such detailed histories about fighters, but you got an emotional attachment to them. Or if you genuinely did just like their moveset better than others. So who really appealed to you off the bat?
Off the bat, it had to be Zangief. And he was a character I used to find very hard to use, but I liked this. He was very different looking, wasn't he? He had the big mohawk. He had that strange hairy chest pattern. He had big muscles, and I didn't have a hairy chest, big muscles, or a mohawk. So I guess I wanted to be like him in some way. But he was the first one that drew me in. But as time went on, of course, the character I loved the most at this point was different in later versions, was Ryu. As I would call him at the time, Ryu. Ryu was the one that's... He was just so frigging cool. And his stage music was the best in the game at the time, as far as I was concerned. And the whole Hadouken, Shoryuken, and the... I'm not even trying to say the Hurricane Kick.
Go on, have a go.
Tatsumaki Senpukyaku.
Beautiful.
Oh, yeah, I got there.
It really
probably isn't...
Don't go to your Japanese restaurant and order it, though.
Hello, I'd like a dragon punch, please. they probably will just punch you instead. So yeah, that's my big thing. The first character that really drew me in was Zangief, because he was just so different, and he was Russian, and his backstory really interested me. And I remember reading a lot about him, about how strong he was, so I thought I'd get an advantage. But obviously, as we know, Zangief's very much a counter player, and he's not somebody that we'd use to go out and attack with. And then when I started getting used to Ryu and the special moves, he was always the character I took most to heart. But then, as of course, as the time went on, it was actually Ken who I used the most.
Yeah, I think I took to Ken first time around for some reason, and then I very much got into Guile. But admittedly, during my first forays into Street Fighter 2, I wasn't very good at executing special moves, so I did spend a little bit of time playing with some of the characters who had the easier moves to pull off. So like Guile has a Sonic Boom Flash Kick, they're quite easy. Or Honda and Banker's just tap, tap, tap button. He's like the 100 hand slap and the electricity. So yeah, I was pretty lame. It took me a long time to get proficient at Street Fighter 2. I think as much out of ignorance and being a little bit intimidated by special moves, because I remember looking in the instruction book, like you mentioned earlier, and I eventually figured out how to do Hadoukens and that good stuff, but I was really flummoxed by dragon punches. Forward, down, diagonal, what?
I know, it seemed very strange, didn't it? Going from like these charging moves and the Hadouken movement, which we all know, down to right as a smooth motion. But doing the dragon punch did seem to be a bit strange. It took me a little while to get used to it. I wish I could say it took me a while to master it, Mets, but the truth is, I got quite good at Street Fighter straight away. Oh. Like, it was just one of those games I played.
I thought you were
going to
make me feel a bit
time.
Better about myself then, mate.
Well, there's other things I can make you feel better about. You're married, for example, and I'm single, so, you know.
Okay.
Swings
I'm winning at life, you're winning at Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, exactly. I can. Oh, no, that was quite horrible of you. Never mind, let's forget about that part.
Fair enough. So, interestingly enough, six buttons didn't seem to be quite as confusing as it might have been a couple of years earlier. Like you say, particularly with the home ports, the Super Nintendo controller was really perfect for this, wasn't it? And a lot of people would still prefer to use that controller over an arcade stick even today. So it made accessibility to the game extremely easy. Perhaps a little bit trickier to wield in the arcade, but it it was almost like the perfect storm. You had this new console with a great controller that just seemed perfect for the game. The game comes out and sales go absolutely crazy.
It was so awesome to be part of it. Like, it was such a privilege. And one of the big parts about it is just like how many people played it and wanted to master it. And they had their own set moves and their own set routines that they would do. And it was all a case of like trying to break that down and beat them. It brought a new level of competitiveness to, I was a very geeky child, which I'm sure is not a big shock to anybody from what they've just heard me saying. This was a level where I could compete with people. I was 7 years old, but I could beat my brother at the game at certain points.
Yeah, that's always a nice feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, and you had the character balance that meant that you could also... This is one of the reasons why it sold so goddamn much, is because it wasn't a game where you picked up the goddamn controller and you had to learn the special moves, otherwise, sayonara. God, where did that come from? I've never said sayonara in my life. You know, it was one of those kind of games where you could pick it up quite quickly. For example, my younger sister could play this, and she always used to be Chun-Li or E Honda, or Blanka, so she could do the whole repeatedly smash a button and just electrocute you, that kind of thing. So you did have this that happened in households. I remember my dad playing it. Like, my dad never played video games, ever. But it drew people in because of the competitiveness. People understood that you were a Russian wrestler, and the other person was a Chinese kung fu girl, and you had to beat the crap out of each other. People got the concept immediately. And because it was handled in such a slick way, and the characters were so enduring, and people understood them and could get behind them, no wonder it flew off the shelves. Like I say, think about that as from a marketing perspective, or like if it was a campaign or a game right now. It's the kind of game that your little sister, who was 6'5" at the time, and your dad, who was around 40-odd at the time, could play and feel completely at home. Mental.
Mm.
You've got to think at the time how inaccessible games were. I think that's a very important point. They're not like they are today.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. And it is important to mention, at least in the non-super competitive scene, that you didn't need to know special moves to actually stand a chance at winning. You certainly did if you want to compete at the very highest level, but it wasn't necessarily about that. It was about beating the guy next to you, who could be anything from Joe Nobody to a certified grandmaster.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's some very interesting competitive aspects around Street Fighter 2. A little bit of machismo, maybe, because I think it's a little bit like football. Everyone thinks they know the most about football, and if you put someone in front of a fighting game, they would probably want to think that they can smash the living crap out of the person they're fighting against, and that was probably part of the appeal of Street Fighter 2. But it was almost like an extension of their own confidence or cockiness, if you like, whereby I want to take this guy and smash this other person to bits. And there was probably a lot of scenes like that in arcades and whatnot, which would be extremely interesting to sort of revisit now, because that's an aspect of gaming history that we simply don't have anymore. We don't have these impromptu challenges walking up to the player 2 position on an arcade and challenging us. We don't have that anymore, but that was where Street Fighter 2 really came to life. Absolutely.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I remember going to the arcades, you would have just people just put a 20p in and then just press play 2. And part of that thing was the fact that you had to beat them to carry on playing. And of course, when you're 7, 8 years old, you know, these people are probably older than you, they might be better. So having to beat them was no tall order sometimes. And these impromptu tournaments that you used to get, they just, as you say, they don't happen anymore. But one of the big things is, you still see this now, of course, with things like FIFA and Call of Duty, maybe to a lower extent. But the fallout she could have with people over Street Fighter was hilarious. The amount of arguments it would cause, because, you know, you're a dick because you keep using, you keep trapping me in the corner. And I can't get out of it. You're a dick. You're abusing the system. And the amount of fallout she used to have, there was something quite naive about them all, because we didn't really know games that well back then.
Yeah.
And that's something that's, we owe to Street Fighter and its enduring legacy, is that the fallouts it made us have with people, and it's easy to see why now, because no one wants to lose.
Yeah, that's very true. I used to have repeated fallouts with my older brother about it, because he was, let's say, an abuser of certain gameplay mechanics of Street Fighter 2. He still says to me today, if I'm ever getting cross at a game, he always just whispers to me, sweep the leg, man, sweep the leg. because that's all. He trapped me in the corner and just continually low attack me like a prick.
Oh, that is a scummy move, though. But in all fairness, I don't approve.
No, but you play to win in this game. It wasn't a,
correct.
Wasn't a cuddly gaming experience. It was super competitive. And whilst on the subject of being super competitive, we've got another very special guest for you on this particular episode of Retro Asylum. A gentleman from our forums who goes by the name of Retro Rick has very kindly donated some of his time to tell us a little bit about the arcade and competitive scene behind Street Fighter 2 in tremendous amount of detail and what is a very interesting story. So I'm going to hand it over to Rick, who's going to tell us a little bit about his experiences in the arcades from yesteryear. So sit back and enjoy.
Hello guys, this is Retro Rick. Just firstly, I'd love to say a big thank you to all the past and present members of the Retro Asylum podcast. I've been really enjoying the show. I just recently found it actually in late 2015, so I've been going all the way back from the start, and I'm up to about episode 40 now, and I've been really, really enjoying it, so well done on that, guys. Secondly, I'd really like to thank Metz for inviting me on this 25th anniversary for Street Fighter 2. Yeah, really, really glad to be a part of this, because Street Fighter 2 for me is probably my... No, not probably. It is actually my favourite game ever in the history of video gaming. So it's a real special honour to be invited on to this show and you know, give my thoughts on the game and, you know, give some information about it. So here we go then. So if we go back to the late 80s, Technos Japan specifically made some brilliant games at that time. Obviously, everybody knows Double Dragon, and a couple of years earlier there was Renegade, which both games are pretty similar, and they both have genre-defining game mechanics. And later on, in 1989, they released WWF Superstars, which is a wrestling game based on WWF. I know some people won't really be interested in that, but as a game, even if you removed, you know, the Macho Man Randy Savage or the Hulk Hogan's of the wrestling world, it's actually a spiritual successor, really, in some ways, to Double Dragon. The fighting system's very similar, and it's obviously been adapted and improved. And that is a fantastic game. You can play two player versus on it. There's tag team elements in it. You can get out of the ring, you smash people over the head with, you know, the stretchers and stuff. It's even got Andre the Giant in it. It's a really fun game, and that's a brilliant Technos game, actually. I'd recommend anybody to go and check that game out, because it's fantastic. But, of course, at the same time as Double Dragon in 1987, Capcom released Street Fighter 1, and originally in the arcades, it had a crazy design choice. They had these two great big pads. The idea was the harder you hit the pads, basically, the harder the punch or kick would be inside the game. And I think location testing, you know, the idea didn't really work out. There was probably people there breaking their hands or definitely leaving the arcades with a sore hand at the end of it. And it didn't really make for tight gameplay or anything like that. So I think that's how Capcom moved to the six-button layout, basically. And, of course, the other really important things about this game, I remember me and my friend, we used to go to the cinema in Bromley, and they used to have a Street Fighter 1 machine there. And we'd jump on it, we'd have a little battle against each other. And I think the thing that drew us to that game was, I mean, games like Double Dragon at the time, they were fantastic. You know, the music, the sound effects, the graphics, it was all big, it was all impressive, it was all really, really cool. And Street Fighter 1, although people say today, you know, it's not aged, it's not a very good game, I think Street Fighter 1, I still have a soft spot for Street Fighter 1. You know, it's nowhere near as playable as Street Fighter 2. But Street Fighter 1 definitely did set some standards. You know, you've got the six-button layout, you've got the big sprites, you've got all the characters from different parts of the world, etc. But one of the big, big elements of the game was that it had special moves. Now, admittedly, they were really, really difficult to pull off. I think the reason for that was because the timing was so strict on how you pull those moves off that it was very, very difficult to actually achieve the correct timing to pull off the Fireball, the Dragon Punch and the Hurricane Kick, etc. So I think that's why it, in a way, it's a failure. But at the time, as a kid, you didn't care. It was just fun. And sometimes a Fireball would come out and you'd be like, wow, look at that. I've just knocked off half the guy's energy. But anyway, Street Fighter 1, of course, is important for setting the special moves and the style and the six-button layout, basically.
Don't forget there are many gods, thank you, all over the world.
Right, so now we move into 1991. I would have been 11 years old at this point. Usually in the summer holidays, we'd have the family ritual of taking a trip down the coast. For me, it was Margate. And, you know, it was all about the beach and looking at the shops. I was always like, oh, let's go in the arcade, let's go in the arcade. And whenever I used to run into the arcade, that smell, people don't really mention it very much, but the smell of, like, the burning light bulbs in all the machines and, you know, you can taste the electricity in the room and that really strange smell of warm coinage and stuff like that. It really, whenever I walk into an arcade nowadays and I smell that smell, it takes me back to that, you know, that period in the 90s when arcades became massive again. So, you know, 91, walking around Margate and going into the arcades and looking for, you know, my favourites, you know, your Double Dragons, your Street Fighter 1s, your Golden Axe, all that type of stuff. And all of a sudden I saw this game and I was like, what the hell is this? And it was Street Fighter 2. Saw the intro screen with the big thumping music with the two guys fighting, then it scrolls up the building, then you see the Street Fighter 2 logo, it flashes round, and this is where I got my first experience of the game. Now, admittedly, you know, I wasn't very good at it because never played it before. And it was totally different to Street Fighter 1, really. There wasn't that sort of strange gravity from Street Fighter 1 where your character would kind of jump up sharply and hang in the air a little bit and all that type of stuff. It was very, very fluid. And there were so many characters as well. This was, like, unbelievable. There's, like, 8 characters to choose. And they were all different, obviously, with the exception of Ryu and Ken. But I'll never forget that first taste of the game. And while we're on the subject of arcade nostalgia, it's just something I just popped into my brain there. Is I don't know if you guys used to do it, but when you used to run into the arcade, the way you would identify where your game was you'd be listening for the theme tune. You'd be listening out for that classic sound of that game you loved. And this was definitely something that happened with things like Double Dragon for me. But Street Fighter 2 was iconic for that because Yoko Shimomura did some amazing music for this game, and whenever I used to go into an arcade after that point, I was just listening for that, you know, that Guile theme or that Ryu theme, or, you know, just pretty much every character had a soundtrack you instantly would recognise. So that was fantastic. I loved the music in this game. It was brilliant. So after coming home from Margate that day, I was like, couldn't get the game out of my head. I was like, damn, I've got to go back and play that game. Where the hell can I play this game? Where is it? And for ages, I was looking for it. And one day I heard that there was a machine in a kebab shop near Bromley Cinema where I used to play Street Fighter 1. So I started going up there on the weekends, you know, after school. And you know, you get there and there's like hundreds of, well, not hundreds, but, you know, there's lots of kids in there playing it. And not many people buying kebabs, basically. And eventually there were quiet periods where, you know, after keep getting beaten all the time, I started talking to this guy who was there, and I can't remember his name now, but basically he showed me, like, the basics of how to play the game properly. So we put, you know, 2 10-piece together to make a credit, and we'd basically take one round each. So we'd select a character, which was usually Ken around that time, and he'd take the first round, and then I would take the second round. And then whilst he was playing, he'd be telling me and showing me bits and pieces. And then I'd try to copy it in my round. And if I lost, he took over so that we didn't lose the credit, basically. So that's basically how I learned the game. And, you know, it's crazy, really, because that's when arcades... Not only did the arcades explode and pop up and become more lively and more exciting. And, you know, all of a sudden, places like kebab shops were like arcades. It was like people weren't even in there to buy the food. It wouldn't surprise me if kebab shop owners and chip shop owners made more money from the Street Fighter 2 machine than they did from the food, basically. Now, back in those early days, obviously there wasn't really much in the way of printed move lists. You know, there was no YouTube, there wasn't an internet at the time either. I mean, this is 91, we're talking about 92. So there was no standard for the names of some special moves. I mean, some moves, obviously, you knew what the character was saying, so that was what it was called. So Guile had the Sonic Boom, for example. Sagat had the Tiger and the Tiger Uppercut. But there were some strange and quite imaginative and funny names for some of these moves. One of the ones particular that I found funny was the Chun-Li has that little... when you jump over an opponent and you press down a medium kick, she does this sort of little head stomp. But in some circles, that was called the tap dance technique, for example. Ryu and Ken's fireball was called the cyclone punch. And I think that was due to poor translation more than anything back in the day. I think it was issue 3 of Nintendo Magazine System, which was released in December 1992. And on the front of that, you had a VHS tape. And it was called Street Fighter 2, A Player's Guide. And that was by Gary Harrod and Julia Rignall. And even Gary Harrod calls it the Cyclone Punch. But there's a citation somewhere on the internet. I think the guy of the original Street Fighter who came up with the names for the special moves of the, in the original Street Fighter, Takashi Nishiyama, if I've said that right, he basically credits a 1970s era anime called Space Battleship Yamato. And there was a missile in it called the Hadoho or something like that. And that basically translates to wave motion gun. And he cites that as the origin for the Hadouken, basically, which translates literally into English as wave motion fist. So really, the Hadouken in English is wave motion fist, but that just sounds pony in English, doesn't it? So we just call it a fireball or a Hadouken nowadays. That was something funny from back in the day, and it's not something that I'd hear people talking about very much, but I'd find that a very funny story. Now, getting down to the competitive scene for Street Fighter 2, of course, you know, the arcades were full of people playing each other all the time. There was always a massive queue with loads of people waiting to challenge the winner and try and see if they can knock them off the machine. Part of the charm and the reason why I think this game became even bigger than it probably initially was because of something called the accidental combo. This basically come about because in the original Street Fighter, as I said earlier, it was very difficult to pull off the special moves. And Capcom decided that in order to make the game more flashy, more interesting to watch, more interesting to play, they decided to loosen up the timing for the inputs. So, you know, if you did the fireball motion and press the punch button within, I think it's 3 or 4 frames, you will throw out a fireball. Now, I'm not entirely sure exactly the mechanics of why this works, but some moves, say, for example, Ryu's standing hard punch, if you do that hard punch and then very quickly do a fireball, it will cancel the hard punch and then go straight into the fireball motion, meaning you will get 2 unblockable hits. And then, of course, that opened the door for people to express themselves and find hidden combos in the game, because not every single move was cancelable. And I'm not sure why they weren't cancelable. I guess this is probably a good time to point you guys towards a Polygon article called Street Fighter 2, An Oral History. It was a piece put together getting sources from Japan, like all the original developers and people behind the scenes, to basically recant their stories and their experiences in the inception and release and explosion of this game. So you get a real good insight into all of the stuff that made Street Fighter 2 such a special game. And continuing on with the competitive side of the game, World Warrior, the very first version of Street Fighter 2, there was quite a few glitches in there. And specifically Guile, he was absolutely broken as hell. There were specific glitches that made fighting Guile an absolute nightmare. And there's been many a story about real fights breaking out because of people using the glitches Guile's got. So let me wrap a quick rundown of the glitches for you so you can get an idea. You can actually find these on YouTube quite easily if you might like to see them. So the first glitch, and probably the least abusive glitch of them all, is the statue. This is basically where Guile ends up standing on one leg and is frozen. it doesn't really cause any major problems because you can hit Guile out of it, but it does enable other glitches and other strange things to go on whilst you're in the statue position. Now, one of the worst glitches which can be performed whilst you're in the statue is invincibility, which basically means you can't hit Guile. Now, that makes competitive play incredibly frustrating, and as you can imagine, it caused lots of problems in the arcades when World Warrior was the only version around. Other glitches which are kind of similar to invincibility for its annoyance is Guile can perform a magic throw or phantom throw, which means as long as he's in with a specific range of his opponent, he will do the animation for a throw, and no matter what your opponent is doing, they will suddenly be thrown, you know, in midair, during a dragon punch, anything, they will be thrown. And then if you're in the right distance, you can perform the magic throw again and again and again before they even get up off the floor. So you can basically win a round without touching the opponent. Now, one more glitch is called the handcuffs. And this is basically where Guile throws the opponent, but instead of releasing them, they get stuck next to Guile in a kind of stance where they look like they've been hit. And Guile can then jump around the screen with the character or his opponent attached to him. And that's basically why it's called the handcuffs. And the worst problem with this glitch is if the timer runs out, the game has to be reset because it's frozen. There is a way of getting out of it, and it requires you to do the phantom throw. So that's the only way to get out of the handcuffs, is for Guile to perform the phantom throw. So you could do the handcuffs, and if someone doesn't know how to get out the phantom throw, you could walk away just to show disrespect. There are some other glitches, but probably the final glitch, which is one of the most annoying ones, is the reset glitch, where Guile literally resets the machine and all the credits get wiped out. And of course, all these glitches were definitely the cause of some proper fisticuffs back in the arcade days. Okay, so finally, because I realise I'm rambling on now for quite a bit of time, I'll move on to the proper competitive scene from the early days all the way up to the modern days. So in around 1992, my local computer shop in Orpington, called the Computer Leisure Centre, had been transformed from, you know, just a simple shop with shelves full of games to practically an arcade. I mean, it still had all the games in there, all the consoles, etc. But the front area of the shop where you walked in became just a sea of kids facing up against each other on Street Fighter 2. There was, I think, five machines, and they were all Champion Edition machines, so they all had the four bosses, etc. And I have fond memories, because it was about this time I had really, really got to grips with the game, and I was doing combos. I was playing lots of different characters, and quite often I'd be at the front of a specific machine, constantly being challenged by kids trying to knock me off, and I would be there all day. So I'd go down there on a Saturday morning for 9 a.m. with a pound, and then 9 times out of 10 I'd leave at like 5:30 when the shop shuts, with enough money to walk past the chip shop and buy a portion of chips for my trip home. So those were some of my fondest memories in my childhood, to be honest. And actually, I just remembered now that they had one of the dodgy pirate boards, which was dubbed Black Magic Edition, I think, at least by the shop owners. And this was one which came out before Hyper Fighting. And it was, if you compared the speed of this game to Hyper Fighting seemed like it was slow motion. This game was just so fast, it was just ridiculous. You could probably get through to the end of the game in 5 minutes. It was that quick. So it was about 1993 when I first picked up the Street Fighter 2 Expert Player's Handbook. And it was basically a player's guide. It had loads of combos in it, loads of techniques, etc. And in the back pages of this book, there was a feature on this American player called Tomo Ohira. And it basically went on to describe how Tomo was an absolute god at Street Fighter 2. And now, you know, at the time, I thought I was the absolute bee's knees at this game. But in this book, it talked about huge tournaments and a huge tournament scene in California where people would, like, playing weekly tournaments, and there'd be national tournaments. And this guy, Tomo, had basically, you know, hardly lost any tournaments. Recently, I did some research on him when I got back into Street Fighter 2 in sort of 2011. And The guy played Street Fighter 2 from 1991 to 1994. He actually retired from Street Fighter 2 just before Super Turbo was released. And his tournament record apparently stands at 80 plus tournaments won, all of varying sizes, and he only failed to win 4 tournaments in his entire playing career, and that's phenomenal. Well, there's actually a video on YouTube called Tribute to Tomo Ohira, the first king of Street Fighter, and there's various quotes from old sources on the internet, like alt groups and stuff like that, and there's just constant streams of information about how Tomo was one step above everybody else. There was even quotes from Japanese players saying that Tomo could have gone toe-to-toe with the best Japanese players of the day. And there was even a professionally produced VHS featuring Tomo and, you know, a lot of his strategies and techniques. And if you want a bit of a 90s nostalgia cheesy trip, then just search YouTube for Tomo Tape Part 1 and Part 2 and you'll find it.
You win! Perfect!
Okay, guys, so there's just the last few bits of information here, which is especially relevant if you're interested in modern-day Street Fighter 2 and the tournament scene. One of the best places to go is www.strevival.com. And, you know, the quote from their website is, "The ST Revival Group is dedicated to preserving and promoting a generation of Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo competition across the US and worldwide." So that says it for you, basically. It's got news, calendar, strategy and resources, tournament results from, you know, the history of all the tournaments that have been played. It's got interviews with, you know, different characters from the scene, you know, players and organisers and, you know, promoters and all that type of stuff. I had the pleasure of meeting quite a few of these guys when I went over to Evo in 2014 for the Tournament of Legends 2. Which I didn't do too badly in. I was in a pool of 16 players and I managed to get fourth. So I didn't make it into the main tournament, but there were so many good players there. It's just ridiculous. For those of you who don't know, Evo is like the biggest fighting game tournament in the world. It's held yearly at Las Vegas and draws, you know, players from all over the globe, and it's a massive weekend event, and you can watch live stream when it's on and you can see the archives on YouTube, etc. So you should check that out too. And actually, this is another thing that's quite interesting about Street Fighter 2 is that over the years there's been like a tier list of like where the characters sit in terms of how strong they are, and gradually over the years the tier list has moved around all over the place because people find new techniques and new strategies, and they're still finding new techniques and new strategies for different characters. There's one specific character called T-Hawk which was always at the bottom of tier lists, and fairly recently he's been elevated quite high because people have found like specific techniques with him which make him a pretty dangerous character if you master him. So it's quite interesting the way that Street Fighter has evolved over the years. People are still dedicated to this game to the extent where they're finding out all this new stuff that's just hidden in the code that were probably not intended at the time by a Capcom, etc. It's really cool. Also, if you want to see some really, really top tier play, check out something called GameSpot Versus, which is on YouTube, and it's basically a winner stays on format event where lots and lots of really good Japanese players are playing off, and they're released regularly. They have these regular meetups. The arcade scene is still massive in Japan, and I really hope to get out there one day and get involved in it and experience that. Quickly sticking to the subject of the Japanese, because their arcade scene is still so strong out there, they actually refuse to play on anything other than the arcade machines. So when they brought Japanese players over to Evo, they had to cater for that because they weren't allowed to have arcade machines on the main stage. So there was a guy called Carl Wickman who basically measured the dimensions of the Japanese Sega candy cabinets, you know, the Astro Cities, the Blast Cities, etc. And he measured them all, you know, from the floor, how wide they were, where the buttons were placed on the panel, etc. And he built these joysticks which sat on these great big metal legs that, so they were like really sturdy and they were almost like playing on the arcade machine, and the Japanese were okay with that. But and there's been similar problems for tournament organisers in the past. Earlier on, sort of like mid-2000s, there was an episode where they played on a PS1 version of Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and that version is, let's say, broken compared to the arcade. There's lots of things that are different in it, and the only version that's close enough to the arcade that people might play is the Dreamcast version. actually the problem of like which version to use to play tournaments on has changed recently, thanks to a guy called Brian Grissom. I don't know if you know how the arcade technology is for the CPS2 hardware. It basically consists of an A and a B board. The B board is the game, and the A board, it acts like the interface for the jammer harness, which connects to the power supply and connects all the buttons and, you know, to the video signal, to the monitor and the audio jacks, etc. So what he did is he took the A board and he ripped out certain components and replaced them and basically consoleized the A board. So it's got a PS1 or PS2 AV connector in it. It takes laptop power supply, and he manufactured these little USB decoders, which you can plug Xbox 360 or PS3 joypads or joysticks into, which catered for people who didn't like to play on sticks or like to play on pads, etc. And it opened up the tournament scene to people who had recently got into Super Turbo through the HD remix, which was released a few years ago. There was like quite a big influx of players because of the release of HD remix. And now the tournament scene is better than it's been for quite a while now, thanks to Brian Grissom's modifications to the A-board. You know, these things are very easily portable to tournaments. You'd have to worry about arcade cabinets, and people can use joysticks that they've been using for, say, Street Fighter 4 or, you know, anything like that. So actually, quickly, just want to plug GrandmasterChallenge.com. It's a UK-based tournament organiser, which I'm part of, and it's run by Michael Power. And we do tournaments all over the UK. Recently did a tournament in Ireland for the first time, which was received very well. So 2014 marked the 20th anniversary of the release of Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo. We actually run a tournament in February that year, which acted as a qualifier for the Evo Tournament of Legends 2. And probably the best player in the UK at the moment, a guy who goes by the name of Orf and plays Ryu, he won our tournament qualifier, which gave him automatic entrance into the Tournament of Legends 2. And this was held in a fantastic arcade called the Heart of Gaming, which is in northwest London. The owner, Mark Starkey, basically went round and salvaged all the old machines from some of the famous hotspots around London, like the Trocadero, Sega World, the Casino Arcade near Good Street Tube Station, the Las Vegas Arcade in Soho, etc. And he restored all these machines, and basically runs his arcade on a flat rate basis. So you walk in, pay £10, and everything there's on free play. If you want to play a specific game and he's got it, he'll put it on for you. It's very friendly there, and there's lots of consoles there if you want to play retro consoles too. And they hold lots of events there as well. So if you're in the London area, or if you're visiting the London area, check out the Heart of Gaming. That is definitely a great place to go. Okay, guys, so I think I'll leave it there. I really hope it doesn't feel like I've been whittling on for three ice ages. I hope you've really enjoyed what I've had to say and the information I've had to share. So I'm now going to go off and become a family man. So thanks very much, and take care.
So thanks to Retro Rip for providing that excellent insight into the arcade and competitive scene in Street Fighter 2. I hope you found it as interesting as we did. It was a really great piece, and we really thank you for taking the time for doing that for us. It's a very unique insight into the Street Fighter 2 scene. So thank you, Rick. We really appreciate it. But whilst we're on the subject of Rick's little piece there, you made very interesting use of sound effects and music from Street Fighter 2, and it's something that we need to go into a bit more detail on. We can't discuss the many amazing features of Street Fighter 2 without giving due appreciation to the musical score by Yoko Shinomura. Mm-hmm. It's without doubt one of, if not the most memorable gaming soundtracks ever compiled. I'm sure you'd agree, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, people will bang on about like Final Fantasy VII, for example, stuff like that. There's other games that are up there that have got great, great soundtracks, Ico, Shadow of the Colossus, that kind of thing. But Street Fighter 2 was a real beginning of having orchestral-like pieces in a game that had real melody, and they really suited the environment. They helped to bring a colour to the whole game. And most of these tracks are really enduring, because I can remember every single one. I can remember every single melody, and it's a bit of a stretch here, because obviously the sound quality is very different, and the CPS board actually had really great sound particularly, but these pieces were like film pieces. They were absolutely excellent. And the, one of the things that you can remember from the arcade was just how amazing the music was. And I can remember Mean Machines brought out one version once where they had a CD included. And the very first time I put that CD on and I heard reused theme. And it's very unique sound and instrument set. Another thing to say about that is the instrument set used on all the levels was different as well. And they all sounded so different. And oh, God, it's amazing. I can't say enough great things.
They're all very appropriate to the various stages from around the world that all the fighters were from. So if you take Ryu's a very sort of Japanese guitar-y type track, and then you have Ken's, which was a very sort of hard rock American track.
Oh, yeah, and it sounds like Mighty Wings that you might have heard for the Top Gun soundtrack.
Yeah, definitely weren't beating around the bush with that one. And then you have stages like Dal Sin. It was very traditional Indian music, yet it seemed appropriate and likable for this game, whereas most people wouldn't go out there and listen to that kind of music off their own volition.
Yeah, and it wasn't corny either. Like, it should be on paper that, oh, this is Dal Sin's level, I know, let's have some Indian plinky music. I don't know what the instrument's called, I wish I did for this aspect, but you know what we're talking about, and you hear it, and you're like, oh, right. But it just it seems to work. And, you know, it's not just Ken Dal Sin's and level. Chun-Li's level sounded great. Sagat's. Oh, God, they're all great. Yeah. I can't... I'm trying to think of... The bad ones, maybe, are, like, the Vegas level, the Spanish level. But my personal favourite, but I can appreciate it. And also the fact that when you were in the red energy, when you were in the flashing energy, that the track would change. Obviously, on the console versions, it would just go faster, but on the arcade, it changed into a different composition. There's a reason why I love music loads, and one of the things I wanted to be in my life as a musician, I learnt lots of different instruments, and one of the reasons I wanted to was, going back a bit before that, as things like the Rocky IV and the Transformers soundtrack, but things like the Street Fighter soundtrack are just as amazing to me, and just as enduring and listenable today. It's fascinating that I can say that as a now 33-year-old man, that this song I heard when I was 7 years old, it's still got as much playback value to me as a hit from the 80s, such as one of Depeche Mode's singles.
No, I totally agree with you. It's extremely memorable in every respect, both as part of the gaming experience or just listening in isolation. It's equally as enjoyable in either setting. And just going back to Yoko Shinomura, who's a ridiculously talented composer, she actually left Capcom not too long after doing Street Fighter 2, left in 1993 to go and work at Square. So she's by far nowhere near a one-hit wonder, let's just say. She'd already had some decent involvement in gaming soundtracks up until this point. She even contributed to Final Fight with a few tracks, and that's also got a very good soundtrack. But when at Square, she went on to do really amazing arrangements for Secret of Mana, Mario RPG, Kingdom Hearts, and the list is endless. It goes on and on and on.
And all that music is really great as well.
They're
all really
games
stunning.
Very fondly remembered for their soundtracks. So if you're less familiar with her work other than just Street Fighter 2, go on YouTube and have a listen to some of her work. It's truly outstanding, and I'm sure you would really enjoy it if you like the stuff on Street Fighter 2.
No. I think it's worth mentioning after Street Fighter 2, not to get too down on 3, 4, and hopefully 5. I've not heard the soundtrack to 5 yet. But the soundtracks are nowhere near as good as what she put together.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. They're not nearly as memorable. And while Capcom have had some good soundtracks for other beat-em-ups, the Street Fighter series in particular, I don't recall any of them out of memory, to be honest, whereas I can listen to them all in my head from Street Fighter 2 quite happily. I remember every key.
Yeah, and me too. It's one of the things I would like to, I've enjoyed doing as research for this podcast, to get myself in the frame of a mind of an excited 7-year-old who wants to tell you about the game. It's been listening to the music. It's been one of my favourite things.
It really does take you back, doesn't it?
The music does, yeah, especially. I mean, I think that's one thing that transcends the podcast that we're doing today in Street Fighter. You know, obviously music has amazing memories intertwined with it. And so when I listen to this music, the appreciation I have for it, the gratefulness is quite profound, I have to say, which might sound a bit cheesy, but that's a very true reflection of my feelings for it.
It's extremely emotive. I can remember feeling certain emotions and sensations that I felt as a child through listening to the music again. Particularly when you get to the boss stages, because that's ultimately a big sign of success when you start getting to Balrog, Vega, Sagat and Bison. And the adrenaline's really pumping by the time you get to their stages. And because they're a lot harder than the conventional characters, at least under the control of the AI, they're always very high-pressure experiences. So the hearing the music really takes you back into these high-stress situations as a child. You know, it really plays a big part of someone's formative years, I think, if they were young during the halcyon days of Street Fighter 2.
I think it's an interesting thing as well to reflect on this music and just think about what your favourite one is. So yes. I hope you don't mind me asking, which is your favourite track from Street Fighter 2?
It's hard to narrow it down to one because I like most of them. I like all of them, and then there's some I like more than others. But I think my favourite is Spanish Vega.
For me, it's got to be Ryu's theme, the Japanese one. To me, that's just like sums up the game for some reason. Not that it's like an overly worthy track from all the rest of them. There's some great ones, Ken's being one of them, but Ryu's one was just... Because I loved Ryu, like, he just embodied, like, I liked his character, the fact he was a loner, like, at the end of the tournament, he wins the tournament and walks away, and I've brought that into my real life somehow. I do things and then just, not just walk away from them, and, you know, I mean, like, I achieve things, and then, like, other people want me to, like, celebrate it, and I don't celebrate it that much. It's quite weird, actually, I've only just realised that that's something I do, but, yeah, God, yeah, Ryu, what a guy, what a guy.
I think that's fair. I reckon most of our people will probably agree with you on that one. And I don't think there's any wrong answer to that question. All great in their own right.
There is a wrong answer.
Go on.
Balrog's level.
The Vegas level.
The Vegas one, yeah.
I think that's pretty good.
I actually quite like it, to be
fair. I was going to say, it might not be as good as Ryu's, but it's still a good piece of music.
It is. It's really, really good. And I think that it's great that we could just sit here and be talking about the music, and it's so joyful to do so.
Moving away from music, as enjoyable as that particular conversation was, we're going to look at some of the more novelty aspects of Street Fighter 2 now. Perhaps a little Pandora's box of interesting quirkiness that we experienced whilst playing the game as kids. Now, we're going to start off with our experience of playing the import game. Now, if we look at stuff like the names of certain characters, which are all now common in the gaming lexicon, but we were venturing into the unknown, trying to pronounce some of these names. Let's go through what we thought people were called back in 1991.
Very good. And I think we need to bring yours to the forefront, because yours are the worst, if I had to be honest.
Yeah, these are more out of laziness than actual intelligent deduction of what these names actually were at the time. So Zangief, I refer to as Zaganiffy. Now that's not like that shouldn't be a translational issue. That was just me being stupid. But yeah, he was Zaganiffy for years for me. And Dalsim was Dalism, which I actually stand by. I think that could be actually what his name is.
No, Dalsim is much better. Dalism. You just don't listen. Ism is like, I don't know, Jism. Like an organism. I said organism, not something else. Or, you know, Buddhism. It's like, it's a reflection of a organization. There isn't many names that, you know, you're a Buddhist, not a Buddhism. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. So Matt, stop sounding so wry.
Yes, you used to, that's another good one, isn't it? Ryu being called. I just said Ryu.
In fairness, everyone had a different way of pronouncing Ryu. We know it's Ryu now. Perhaps thanks to his pronunciation in Street Fighter, the animated movie, that settled it for me. But a lot of people called him Ru. A lot of people called him Ryu. A lot of people called him Rai. So I can be forgiven for getting that one wrong ever so slightly.
Can you be forgiven? I don't forgive you. Flagellate yourself right now with a whip.
No.
Go get it.
No,
go get a belt.
And how about some of the special moves then? Because a lot of these, again, they're super common now in gaming terminology. We know the name of a Hadouken and sure you can. But we didn't know what they were at the time. And because we're dealing with 16-bit hardware, it was difficult to deduct precisely what they were saying. So
I think you should go with the Chun-Li one first, the one that you'd come up with.
I know this wasn't obviously what it was, but we did refer to it as a spinning bird shit.
It doesn't sound that far off, though, in the actual game.
No, it doesn't.
And the favourite one that you said you used to think it was is...
I'll tell you what, I'll actually perform it. I won't just say it, I'll perform it. Oh, you get...
Oh, you get, yeah, very good. But obviously, we couldn't know his sore you can. And obviously, it was very confusing that a character was called Ken, and that some of the moves also had Ken in them. So my party trick, of course, would be that I used to think he said, "Saw you can." And as soon as I used to do a "Saw you can," I would say, "Down the shops." Don't know why, "Down the shops." There's so many things that you could see Ken doing. I picked "Down the shops." Used to make seven-year-olds laugh. Probably made you laugh at home as well, hopefully.
You probably think we're absolute idiots at this point. But anyway, how about the Tatsunaki Senpukyaku, whatever you want to call it? I hope I said that right.
Well, this is what I think it sounded like in the actual game, and I will perform it for your listeners' pleasure.
Go on.
That's it. There you are. It's like, that's perfect. That's exactly how it sounded.
That sounded as mumbled as the actual sound effect, though. What were you actually saying?
But that... But it, I don't know what it is. It's just a collection of noises.
Whereas I would say, a bastard broke it.
A bastard broke it, yeah. We knew it wasn't that, though.
Did we? I mean, did we, though?
I don't know. We didn't. This is the thing, you see. And then, as obviously, we found out, like, these all just meant very rubbish things in Japanese. They meant things like Dragon Punch or Fire Punch, for example. I don't know what Hadouken is, actually. I'll have to think about it again. But the point being is that they meant very lame things, but in Japanese they sounded absolutely amazing. And didn't it annoy you that Chun-Li was Chinese, but when she did her spinning bird kick, she said spinning bird kick, not Hao Jing Lao Dao or something?
It's a fair point.
It is a fair point. Why? Because she speak English. But when... Ryu of Japan channels his energy, he said, "Sure, you can." And how come Ken didn't say, like, "Fireball" or "Dragon Punch"?
Because he was trained by Gouken.
And how come his voice was the same?
Oh, I don't know.
Do you know why?
Technical limitations.
Exactly. Of course it was technical. Oh, and one last one of the misheard names, or sorry, the misheard... the mispronunciation, sorry, so to say, is E. Honda when he used to win a game, and he used to say Deuce Point, obviously a fan of tennis.
Deuce Point?
Yeah, it's Deuce Point.
He definitely
yeah.
didn't say Chop Suey.
You thought he said Chop Suey?
No. Again, I was young and very ignorant. You know, I pride myself now on international pronunciation. But I was 7, 8 years old. I didn't care. So there were some very interesting memories for that of absolute ignorance back in the day.
I think it's quite funny that to Japanese people, these shouts of like Shoryuken must have sounded like really lame. A bit like, have you ever seen that video of those real life role players getting like balls of cotton and thrown at each other and like, Dragon Strike, Lightning Strike. Lightning Strike, it must sound like that to them.
Wow.
I suppose it sounded so exotic and amazing.
We're getting into a whole other subgenre here, folks. So I'm going to swiftly move on to something else.
Hi, this is Lauren Lanning from Oddworld Inhabitants, and you're listening to Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Some of the international translation issues that came with Street Fighter 2, namely the issue of boss names, which is a very famous thing, a bone of contention for any import games player of all time. So if we start off with what they are known in the West, so we have the Boxer, aka Balrog.
Balrog, yes indeed. Don't know why he's called Balrog. Sounds awful.
Because he's a fiery being.
Oh, right. Well, just call him Bogroll.
Yeah, it's about as useful as a bug roll. And yes. Second, you would have our Spanish dancing cage fighter, Vega.
Who reminds me a bit of a certain person that we used to work with now for some reason. I can't say his name, but maybe I'll say it to you after.
You can tell me off. Yeah, great.
Yes, that'll be good.
Sagat was always Sagat, and that's fair enough. I'm glad that that's well and truly established, and so no issues there. And your final boss was the horrible... M. Bison. He was a
horrible.
Bugger.
He was all right. I thought he was quite.
He
a
was
nice
a
bloke.
Dirty bastard on 8-star difficulty. But anyway, so originally when the game came out in Japan, these names were a little bit different. They were all the same names, but in different order. So our first boss, the boxer, was M. Bison. Obviously obviously a play on Mike Tyson, who was very big at the time.
Say it isn't so. Yeah. Say it isn't
and
so.
And I think it's this one entry that has caused the whole switcheroo and all of these character names, because the rest of them would have just stayed as they were. But M. Bison was such a provocative issue outside of Japan that it would have ensured that Capcom almost definitely got sued, especially given how Mike Tyson needed the money quite badly in the early 90s.
So oh, God, yeah.
They created a rod for their own back there. Our Spanish cage fighter was the original Balrog.
Yes, he was indeed. And I don't know why he's called Balrog either, because it's not very Spanish, is it? You know, it's not like... Why they couldn't they call him like Francisco or Raul?
Mm, yeah, that would have worked quite well.
Yes, it would.
And they tried to make him a little bit more menacing. Anyway, Spanish cage fighter with Balrog, and he was always a bugger to beat. I think I had more difficulty with him than anyone else as far as the bosses were concerned. And Sagat was always Sagat, so fine. And your final boss was Vega. How much does this bother you as a fan of the import scene, or does it not bother you at all?
Do you know what? When I was a kid, it used to bother me, and I used to purposefully say to people, no, he's not Balrog, he's M. Bison. Because you know what? That made me cool, didn't it? That I knew something that they didn't. Actually, in Japan, it's M. Bison. And you know what? Most of these, and the only one who doesn't have any problem with this is Sagat, who turned out, you know, quite normal all the way through the whole franchise. You know what? Balrog, the boxer, we'll just say the boxer, the cage fighter with the claw. You know what? They're all pretty crummy characters, so on reflection, I'm not bothered about it anymore. But at the time, I was massively bothered. And the fact that I can remember when I first got the Japanese Street Fighter 2 at home, that when I first faced the boxer, he was called M. Bison, I went, no way, his name's M. Bison, and all the names were different than what I expected from what was in the magazines that I used to read. So that was quite a shock. But then it made so much sense that he was called M. Bison. I was like, oh, M. Bison, Mike Tyson. Like, makes perfect sense. And why M. Bison was the actual end character, and he had an M. dot, I have no idea. Once he called something like General Bison. Mm. I don't know.
It's specifically the M that causes the trouble, because if they just called the dude Bison, surely that there's enough element of doubt there to avoid a lawsuit.
He does look like Mike Tyson, though, doesn't he, from back in the day?
Yeah, he's blatantly based on Mike Tyson, but so what?
I mean, they could have called him anything. They could have called him
Buster Douglas.
Buster. Mr. Jenkins. You care, like, why did it have to be Bison, Tyson? It's like a rhyme.
And interestingly enough, this whole facade is stuck with the series. It's still the case in Japan that the bosses have these names that are different to the Western releases. And you would think they'd just... Okay, we can be forgiven for getting it wrong in the first version, but why have we done it for 25 years?
It must be like an admin task that they all hate doing. They all get together. They're going to make a new Street Fighter, and they say, by the way, folks, you know what the Americans and Europeans like? M. Bison needs to be Balrog, and they all sit around and go, oh, for God's sake, I've got to just put this around now. It must really get on some people's nerves.
Yeah, I guess
especially
it does.
Marketing.
And just a little bit of trivia on this particular subject that I obtained from discussions with Retro Rick, that in international competitive play, because of the naming confusion, I don't think most competitive players bother with the bosses, with the exception of the final boss, so M. Bison in the West, Vega in Japan. They simply refer to him as the Dictator to avoid confusion.
Oh, right. That is interesting, because he does look like the Dictator, apart from he hasn't got a massive beard.
Mm. Yeah, he'd be more dictatorish if he was actually more akin to Raul Julia, like he is in the movie. A bit more maniacal.
I wasn't... Yeah, Raul Julia just wasn't very menacing, was he?
No, he played a good dictator, though, with, like, I am M. Bison!
No, I don't think so. Raul Julia famously took on that part. It was one of his last part. It was his last part that he did before he died, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And he only did it because his kids wanted him to do it,
That's
apparently.
Very true.
It's such a shame.
Whilst we're on the subject of the movie, we're not going to venture into that too much, but it is one of my favourite bad movies ever. I watch it every time it's on TV. It's so bad, it's brilliant. It's just not really that Street Fighter related, unfortunately.
I love the bit about how Zangief is quite thick, and they're in some kind of hut, and somebody's coming hurtling along and it's on CCTV and he says, quick, change the channel. That's actually quite funny. Quick, change the channel.
So you remember stuff, so it obviously had a positive impact on you, so that's great.
Well,
so,
it didn't have a positive impact. I cried for a week and I still talk about it in therapy.
Oh, so, that's unfortunate. You know, but at least you remember one way or the other, so it's had an impact on you one way or the other. So moving on, now there was a few interesting mythology pieces about Street Fighter 2 and some April Fools are noteworthy as well. So let's talk about the whole Dragon Punch Shoryuken situation, how this is just basically a whole badly translated mess that has led to some big mythology issues with Street Fighter 2.
Do you know what's really interesting? Before, when you were saying that was it Gouken you said trained Ryu and Ken?
Yes.
And then he said, is it not Shenlong as a kind of like a red herring
well,
for the rest of the...
That's the thing. If we were talking about literally from Street Fighter 2, we would be correct to assume that it was Shenlong, given what Ryu says in his interfight scenes, because that's the only clue that we had to it at the time. But as the franchise has moved on and story has developed, we now know that it's Gouken, who's the brother of Akuma stroke Gouki. But at this point in the whole timeline, all we know is you must defeat Shenlong to stand a chance.
Yes, which then got translated into you must defeat my Dragon Punch to stand a chance, which is the actual literal translation that it should have been. He was referring to his own special move.
Of course, but again, translational issues sat us down the wrong path of that one, didn't they?
Yeah, and Shenlong, isn't that Dragon Punch in Chinese?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so we have this, and then we've all thought that Shenlong was some kind of hidden character, or there was like always rumours in the playground and that kind of place that, you know, Shenlong...
Have you beaten Shenlong yet? He's well old.
If you've beaten Shenlong yet. And I'd be like, standing on my little soapbox, I was quite a small child, I'd be like, no, Shenlong doesn't exist, you're talking shit. And people used to swear to them blue in the face that Shenlong was real, and he wasn't, of course. But that didn't stop there being some interesting pieces of mythology going around that Shenlong was indeed his teacher, and he had a big white beard and all this kind of stuff.
Well, this is the interesting thing, especially given that this is all pre-internet, that a lot of this folklore got around the playgrounds, it got around the arcades, and it also got into gaming publications. Now, Electronic Gaming Monthly, who were one of the big mags in America at the time, they ran a very convincing April Fool, let's say, where they, quote-unquote, doctored, not Photoshop, because that didn't exist at the time, doctored a screenshot of, I think it was Ryu fighting what appeared to be a new character in Street Fighter 2. And it was basically using the Ryu sprite, but it was in a grey uniform, I think, and had long grey hair, and this was supposed to be Shenlong.
Yeah, and of course this meant that this was the proof that we'd all been waiting for, that Shenlong existed.
Yes, and a lot of people fell for it. And I'm sure there's still people who would tell you to the blue in the face that he's somewhere in the code, somewhere.
And he's not. Like, that's, please could we stop it? It makes me sad just thinking about it. Because I remember at the time, I used to say, he doesn't exist. It's not true. And it probably paved the way for Akuma or Gouki. We'll just say Akuma for this podcast.
Yeah, it
podcast
probably also
exist.
Had some minor influence on where they went with later iterations of Street Fighter, because the mock-up that EGM did with the long grey hair didn't look too dissimilar to the long blonde hair that Ken has in Street Fighter Alpha in years to come. So whether that had a direct influence on it or not, but it's just a little bit quirky how these things work out.
It is. And I think that obviously this wasn't the only April Fool around it that happened, but it's just so interesting that because this was so ingrained in our community and what we were talking about all the damn time, of course, this is how, like, myths get perpetuated. People sat around a campfire and they said, oh, this right hard man from around our way, he cut down six people with a sword. It's the same kind of thing. Oh, yeah, Ryu's trained by Shenlong. Yeah, you got to play him, otherwise you haven't completed Street Fighter 2 until you have. It's brilliant. It's so creative, and it makes me smile that, of course, it was so much harder to prove these things as wrong back in the day.
Yeah, pre-internet, we couldn't Google it and show them that we're incorrect, unfortunately. We just had to humour them, but dismissively. But we all know now that while Shenlong is not in Street Fighter 2, he is a striker who plays for Southampton in the English Premier League.
Shenlong.
Exactly. You must defeat Shenlong to stand a chance. Let's talk about some of the various additional iterations beyond Street Fighter II, The World Warrior. So Street Fighter II is famous for having a variety of different releases over the years that came after the initial release. Capcom, of course, very eager to milk their cash cow considerably hard. And let's talk about some of the most famous ones. So immediately after The World Warrior came Champion Edition, which is probably the most widely released version in the arcades.
Yes, and it's the one that most people would have had the experience of playing, and it was also meant to be. At the time, people used to call it Street Fighter 92, and I think that's something to do with the fact that there was an apostrophe after the 2 to signify that it was Championship Edition. So I think they were like trying to say it was like, oh, it's 92, but it's missing now. Like, it's missing a 2. Missing a 9. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that enabled you, of course, to be able to play as the same characters as each other, because you had costume swaps. But also, the playground rumour that you could play as the bosses came true, because the bosses became playable characters.
Yeah, and I think everyone really clamoured to this version, particularly on its home release, for that reason. But I think people passed up on the bosses pretty quickly. They became a little bit boring once the initial novelty wore off. But hear anyone say, oh, I love playing as Sagat, for instance.
Sagat was all right in Street Fighter Alpha, from what I can remember, but in the actual Street Fighter 2, I always hated Sagat. I just thought he was lame. And you know what? I just kept on playing with Ryu and Ken all the way through, pretty much. Those are characters I like playing with the most, so...
Yeah, that's fair enough. And then we get some more interesting iterations of Street Fighter 2 as some, let's say, technically minded individuals started hacking the ROMs in the arcade and doing some very interesting experiments with the CPS system and coming up with their own homebrews, if you like, of Street Fighter 2. The most famous of them probably being the Rainbow Edition, which is absolutely legendary in the Street Fighter 2 early arcade scene.
Yeah, there's lots of hacks, and they're all called the Rainbow Edition by the people who played them, but they aren't all known as a Rainbow Edition. The Rainbow Edition, when Street Fighter 2 came up, it looked like it was a rainbow on the actual title screen, the Street Fighter 2 logo. And you could do all kinds of crap in this. Your charging moves had no charge time, so you'd let you go back forward and press a button. Your Sonic Boom would go dead slow, but 6 of them come out at the same time. You could do a Dragon Punch, and you'd do 6 fireballs at the same time. You could do fireballs in midair. Basically, it's like someone took an Action Replay to it and stapled it to it and just put the fingers around it and just said, do your worst. Because all these Rainbow Editions and the Kiryu versions, they're all crap, and they shouldn't be played. They should all just be mocked and laughed at, and they are quite amusing for you to go and look at on YouTube. If you search like Street Fighter Rainbow Edition, you just look at it and just go, how could you cope? And the worst thing that used to happen with these goddamn games, they were always in chip shops, in paper shops. I swear to God, what it used to be is you used to get a phone call from somebody and they used to say, hey, you want Street Fighter 2? I can get you Street Fighter 2 for a price that is cheaper than the main, what you can get from another supplier. And they go, oh, that sounds good, that does. And then obviously they get this hacked version that was bullshit and wasn't worth playing. You'd put a pound in or whatever, 20p, back in the day, and your credit would run out straight away because basically the bosses, you could change character by pressing start. It's a complete abomination. I wish they'd all got rounded up and burnt in a goddamn fire. Mm. That's how much I like the Rainbow Editions. That's how much I like hacks.
Yeah, they were novel and amusing, but ultimately unplayable. But it does lead to some interesting changes in the next release of the official Street Fighter 2 game. The hack community stumbled onto some things which people genuinely wanted to see. So I think Capcom eventually released Hyper Fighting, which is the much quicker version of Street Fighter 2, which was, again, a byproduct of hacks. And there are some additional moves in that game, and it was pretty damn popular at the time. So it sort of sent Street Fighter 2, in terms of the official release, in a slightly different tangent of it was going in.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one that's commonly known as Turbo over here.
Yeah.
Street Fighter 2 Turbo. And this is the one where obviously the game played much faster, which happened from hacks. You've got palette swaps for all the characters. Chun-Li has now got a fireball. Basically, I think every character apart from
Zangief.
One character. Yeah, Zangief hasn't got a... No, Zangief's got extra special moves as well. Like, he's got a...
Oh, sorry, I thought you were talking to projectiles, but...
Oh, yeah, he hasn't got a projectile, but basically everybody gets it. An extra special move apart from one character whose name escapes me, and that's a shame. But they really went to town to try and capitalise on the fact that Street Fighter got so much traction that they just brought out Street Fighter again, put on Turbo, and I love all the colour swaps. This is my favourite version. And the fact that Chun-Li had a fireball now, for example, it made it easier to use her in certain situations as well. So I welcomed all these additions, and I think most people did. I think where it got a bit sad though was obviously at home. These changes weren't really enough to warrant you paying for the game again at full price. It would be DLC now if this game existed right now.
Mm-hmm. That's probably fair enough. That slightly changes though when we eventually get on to Super Street Fighter 2, which is as close to a sequel within that actual Street Fighter 2 framework as we were ever going to get. We introduce four new characters. There's a bunch of palette redesigns again, as you said about Turbo. They really go to town on the artwork. It actually starts to become a very different looking game than the original Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, well, the thing that happened with Super Street Fighter 2 is that it's definitely my least favourite Street Fighter. I don't like the actual artwork that they came up with.
Me neither. I much prefer default Street Fighter 2 artwork.
And I think also one of the other reasons why I didn't like it that much is that the fabled music that I love so much, they re-engineered it and rearranged it. And when I mean by rearranged, I don't mean like they rewrote the soundtracks. But the one thing I would say is that, wow. Yeah, it's just horrible. Street Fighter, Super Street Fighter 2, and I will say, it hasn't got super moves in. It's Street Fighter 2 Turbo where it super moves came in. For whatever reason, Super Street Fighter 2 was just such a massive letdown. The new characters sucked. Cammy and... Well, Cammy's my favourite one out of all of them. DJ was crap. T-Hawk, I mean, what an absolutely rubbish character. Feathers and all that. It's like, oh, T-Hawk, oh, look, he's like some kind of Native American.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because what you alluded to at the beginning when we were talking about the various worldly designs of characters not being cheesy or stereotypical, T-Hawk was very stereotypical. I would have come to the same conclusion about T-Hawk as you. Didn't enjoy using him, thought he was excess to requirements in the game. But as Retro Rick said in his piece, that the rankings of how effective certain characters are in the competitive scene always had T-Hawk at the bottom until recently, where people started to discover new techniques to actually make him extremely dangerous. So because the gameplay has evolved, because it's been played now for 25 years, people have actually found genuine tactics and ways to use T-Hawk effectively, which simply wouldn't have come to mind originally. So if this game hadn't been played for such a long period of time by such a fanatical fan base, everyone would have dismissed a character like T-Hawk as rubbish, and rightly so. But because we're this far in, and you know, adding the internet next to it, people are sharing information, tactics, and stories about how they're using certain characters, and people have come up with genuine routines on how to use T-Hawk in competitive play. So
I find that fascinating, Ardy. I think that's great. One thing I will say, my enduring memory of Super Street Fighter 2 is not good enough. It took all the real soul of the game. They changed all the artwork of the character selection screen. The actual character's artwork on there was changed. It wasn't for the better, in my opinion. What I did like was the fact that you had eight different costumes you could pick from. So I always liked being Ken and making him wear a white suit for some reason. And yeah, it's very obvious that Super Street Fighter 2 was a stepping stone to Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, which I actually like. And as I'm sure you're going to tell us, obviously it's huge in the competitive scene, and it's still seen as the correct, it's the version from Street Fighter 2 to play.
I'm going to move on to a little roundup about the home conversions, as there were many of the original Street Fighter 2, or perhaps some of the later ones had their own specific release that correlated to a certain arcade version. So let's start with the Super Nintendo. That's the most famous one, the best-selling one, arguably the one that had the biggest impact. So tend to veer away from scoring things out of 10 on Retro Asylum, but I think if we're harking back to classical old magazines, you can either use the out of 100% or do out of 10. What would you give this one?
Yeah, Street Fighter 2 is a 10. There is very few games. I mean, it's a 9 at least. But I'm going to say 10 because we're still sitting here talking about it 25 years later.
I think that's fair enough.
And I think, yeah, that's its enduring legacy. It's a 10 out of 10 game. It did everything that and actually I can break this down for you in lots of different facets. The actual game itself, forget about its box art or anything that goes around it. The actual enjoyment of the game is excellent. It was pioneering. This is the slickest fighter that was ever made at the time. This invented the genre of one-on-one fighting with combo systems. This introduced the combo system, which was a happy accident from what happened within this goddamn game when it was programmed. And this also had some of the best design in some of the characters that had had great bios and stories that you believed in and made you buy into them even further. And if you've mastered one character, the game wasn't over. You had to master 8 characters. I'm basing this on the first version, of course. Mm-hmm. And then you take it from a marketing perspective. It sold millions and millions and millions. It was a colossal success. It was a critical success. People couldn't wait to tell people go and buy this game. It was amazing value for money.
A 10 out of 10 game, and it definitely coined, and it's an untrue statement, but it coined it nonetheless, the term arcade perfect, which we know it isn't possible because a Super Nintendo is not a CPS, but it was so close that you didn't care about the very small aspects that didn't make it arcade perfect. As far as you're concerned, you had Street Fighter 2 in your house for a fair price.
It's a game I played for like 3 years straight until we got like Super Street Fighter 2 or Turbo, whatever it was. And the thing I would say about that is that, wow, with Street Fighter 2, that when we got it home, it really was as faithful as it can be to the arcade with the hardware that it had. And it had better music than most games at the time on the Super Nintendo. And the graphics were excellent. The sprites were really big and clear. And there was no, like, discernible slowdown, that kind of thing. So it was a technical accomplishment for the system at the time. One of the things I used to do, though, is I love the arcade music so much, is that I used to play the CD at the same time as I played it on the SNES. I used to go onto, like, so if I used to play Ken, then I go to Ken's music and I play Ken's music while I was playing.
Oh, what are you going to say? You put on the Top Gun soundtrack. Needless to say, it's a massive cultural shock to the system, the Super Nintendo release. And if you were one of the folks, and there's no shame in if you are, that you only played this on PAL, you're playing a much slower game, and you haven't played Street Fighter 2 at home until you played an NTSC version, unfortunately.
I was about to say that was another thing that used to go around, is obviously, with it being Japanese, it was faster and full screen. Oh,
yeah.
Those are the days, man, when 60Hz is something to be proud of.
It was, absolutely. A big, big difference. So, on to more of the more popular home conversions, and we'll just skim over these because, you know, the Super Nintendo one hits the nail on the head and the rest fall slightly shorter for various reasons. Next one up is probably PC Engine.
Oh, God, we've had a conversation about this offline, haven't we, while we were researching this? At the time, people were literally up in arms and pretty brown-nosing about this version because it looked so great compared to what other PC Engine games were out at the time. And the thing I would say is that you look at it from a technical accomplishment for an 8-bit system, and it looks great. It's a little bit washed out compared to the Super Nintendo version, but, you know, that's forgiven considering the fact it's a PC Engine. And this is on Hue card, not the CD, so it's not as good-looking as what some PC Engine games are, but that being, like, Dracula XX, for example. But the sound on the PC Engine version is crap. I just don't... So for me, it's a very tainted memory for me, because I can remember seeing it in the Arc... It's Championship Edition. I always say Championship Edition. It's Champion Edition. And that means obviously you get the bosses and that kind of thing. So is it an accomplishment for the PC Engine at the time? Yeah, it is. But you know what? Super Nintendo version's a lot, lot better.
Yeah.
And at the time it was kind of reported, like, because it was a Champion Edition and all that, it was like, oh my God, it's like almost as good as the SNES version. It's amazing. Go and get it. Nah, don't buy it. Just don't buy into it.
I
was lucky enough to have a SNES, though.
I find this version is very impressive. It's definitely flawed compared to the SNES one. The sound is a lot worse. Graphically, it looks really good, and it plays pretty well. So the fact that it got onto there at all in a better-than-playable fashion is a really big achievement. And it's interesting you mentioned about the Hue card, because the capacity for those is very small, and they got a good game in there on the Hue card. But the original Street Fighter 1 was the first ever CD-ROM game in the world.
That is true, yeah.
Why didn't they put it on a CD?
I don't understand. Probably because of adoption rate.
Yeah, I imagine you've hit the nail on the head with that. They needed to sell it to as many people as possible, and most people in Japan only had the core PC Engine system.
I'm glad it exists, but I guess my kind of like the reason why I'm a bit snobbish about it or a bit dismissive is the way it was talked up in the press at the time, like by Mean Machine and stuff like that. You'd think it was some kind of crowning glory. It's not as good as the SNES version. And that's the thing that annoys me. It's like it was kind of reported at the time. It was all kinds of this, that, the other. It's a good second.
Does the fact that it's third. Champion Edition make up for the fact that it's not as good as the bog standard Street Fighter 2 on the SNES?
At the time it came out, probably, because obviously you get the access to the bosses, which you didn't have on the original Super Nintendo version. So I think that's fair comments. That does give it a nudge in the right direction. Mm. It's kind of hard in retrospect to appreciate that. I guess it would be a bit like, I can't even think of any comparison. It's like getting extra map packs on Black Ops 3 and they don't come out for the Xbox One or something. It make you want to play it on the PlayStation 4.
It's like exclusive DLC these days, yeah.
Yeah, and so would that make you sway you to play on a different system? I think overall, the PC Engine version, it's not one I'll ever play.
Okay,
ever.
Fair enough. I'd give it a decently high rating, though. Certainly not 10 out of 10, but maybe like a 7.5. It's a very good game.
I'd give it a 6. I think you've been dead generous.
Fair enough. But keep in mind what we just said about exclusivity when we start talking about the Mega Drive / Genesis version. Because this is where the biggest argument's going to be. We are going to hear shots fired talking about this one.
So, shots fired! Shots fired!
Arguably, or not even arguably, it's definitely, the original Street Fighter 2 swung the console wall in favour of the Super Nintendo. The Mega Drive was clamouring for its own version for a very long time. And eventually it got Champion Edition. Big deal. And a good game in its own right. Where does it fit in the whole Street Fighter 2 mix as far as Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo is a 10 out of 10? Where do we put the Mega Drive version?
Oh, okay. Well, if you put it in that context, this is another good bone of contention, isn't it? I remember buying this. I remember buying it specifically on release day and buying 2 6-button control pads. So that's a massive... I've got to give it a mark down for the fact that you had to buy a 6-button pad to get it, which you had to do for the PC Engine as well, in all fairness. The Mega Drive version, the graphics were good, but they weren't as good as the SNES version, and the sound was completely awful. It was friggin' horrendous. I will say that much. It was novel to play it on the Mega Drive, because it was special Champion Edition, which means that basically it's Turbo and Champion Edition put together. I don't know why that's an actual selling point. I guess the fact that you could put it on Champion Edition, play it slower, and play Ryu in a grey suit rather than a blue and white suit is something to be proud of. I don't get it, and it's something I can remember being disappointed in the time. I truly wish I'd had it on the Super Nintendo instead, the Turbo version. It was a massive mistake on my part, and it cost me more money. I'm very surprised people think the Mega Drive version's better than the SNES version. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how you can make that. It just isn't. Like, it's like trying to say that it's better than the arcade version somehow. It's very, very obvious that it's SNES, then Mega Drive, then perhaps PC Engine. In fact, I think the sound's better on the PC Engine than the Mega Drive. I'd go as far as to say that.
That's pretty big. Tell us about some of the main differences between the two, because it can't surely just be sound. How is the SNES one physically a better game than the Mega Drive one? What was the key difference for you?
Well, the graphics, they weren't washed out, but they just didn't have...
Didn't look as crisp, did it?
Yeah. And not as far as I was concerned, no. It looked a bit more, I was going to say blurry. It's going a while back now to think of it. But I can remember getting Street Fighter 2 Turbo and playing that on my Super Nintendo at the time, and then playing the Mega Drive version. I can remember being so disappointed to get it on the Super Nintendo. I'm still annoyed about it to this day. So I'm going to have to take back what I said about the PC Engine version being a 6 out of 10. That's a lousy number to give it. It's so unfair. It's at least a 7, 7.5, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
The Mega Drive version is like a 6. I mean, maybe even a 5.
Wow.
Because when you take the source material that they had to work on, I can't believe that people think it's as good. It's not as good. You're lying. It's patently, if you put both side by side, the Mega Drive version is nowhere near as good.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing to give it serious marks down on is the sound. We all know the sound's not as good as the Mega Drive. And the sound samples of, like, the announcer you lose, you win. It's awful.
Yeah, they're very muffled, aren't they? Electronic. Yeah. Blurb.
Then you can. And that, and people might be saying at home, well, you know, that's a limitation of the system. Not everybody had a Super Nintendo. And you're correct. And that's it. It's just a point I'm making about if you had to compare the console versions side by side, Mega Drive versions, it's just, it played well enough. The mechanics were the same. But if I had to pick one or the other, it is a Super Nintendo version. I'm not some kind of Nintendo fanboy. Mm-hmm. I keep running out of things to say that it is just better. I'm shocked anybody would think it wasn't.
Yeah.
I
think you've gotten the essence of the argument correct there. If you're looking at pros and cons between the two, you're looking at its Champion Edition, play as the bosses. Very nice. Advantage over the original Super Nintendo version. But then you take poor sound, slightly less impressive visuals, and the fact you're going to have to invest in additional hardware with a 6-button controller to play it properly, becomes a very expensive game. And when you're looking at it in terms of value, it then stops being as much value as the Super Nintendo version.
If I'm not mistaken, it cost £90 altogether, or £100, something like that, to get two pads plus the game.
And that's a lot of money for a game that was venturing on for like 18 months, 2 years old at that point.
Yes, and I think the one point to make about this, if you compare it side by side for the Street Fighter 2 to on the SNES, but don't forget Turbo was out. So it wasn't really that much of an advantage, really. Or Turbo had just come out not that much long afterward. It's a shame, really. It could have been so much more, but there's a reason why it didn't come out on the Mega Drive for quite some time, and that's because the Mega Drive just wasn't good enough to play this game.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And we're saying this as fans of Mega Drive. We love the Mega Drive. So
I mean, I was playing it just before I came on this podcast.
There you go.
I love my Mega Drive and my Mega CD, but there were just certain games that were handled on it which weren't as good as the SNES.
If you want to even the balance for listeners who are on the 16-bit wall fence here, the Super Nintendo had the best Street Fighter 2, the Mega Drive via Mega CD had the best Final Fight, so there you go. So let's whiz through the home version, the home computer versions here, because there was a lot of them.
I'm so excited about this, you know.
Let's start with the elder tech. So let's start with the Spectrum. I delved into this for the first time in preparation for this podcast. It's almost like a certain bit of my memory is erased because the fact that this even exists astounds me, even now.
Yeah.
And this game, it looks, as far as Spectrum goes, it looks really good. I'm so impressed by the visuals. The animation's clunky as anything, and
yeah, 5 frames per second.
And yeah, the frame rate's terrible. It's not the most playable game in the world. But the fact it's there at all, you know, Specione has got to their slice of Street Fighter 2 is so wonderful. It's not a good game, but I almost don't care. The fact that it's there makes me really happy. So,
I mean, you know, you look at it and like all the screens like one colour. The Spectrum, in fact, most of your 8-bit consoles of this, sorry, 8-bit computers of this time, they weren't built to play this kind of game.
No, they weren't. I mean, we're playing dumbed-down versions of very sophisticated arcade hardware here, but
as far as I'm concerned, it could have been just like one of those games, you know, like a Game & Watch, the ones you used to get, like those Tiger Electronic games.
Yeah.
That's how good the Spectrum version is.
Mm. Yeah.
It looks, as a still, it looks kind of impressive considering it's a Spectrum.
Mm.
But I mean, they'd have been better off not making it and saving the money, in my opinion.
I'm sure it still made them a lot of money, though. So people would have bought it out of curiosity because people gobbled up these arcade classics back on the 8-bit computers. Yeah. So they
tell me about it. I used to have an Amstrad. I was doing it all the time.
Well, there you go. Let's talk about the Amstrad one then.
Well, I mean, this one came out a bit afterward, and looking at it,
wasn't this 1993? Like a really late release.
Yeah, it was, and there's Amstrad people are very interested in this because it got re-released again, like somebody took it on in 2008 and made another version of it, which, you know, you've got to take your hat off to people to keeping the retro scene alive and doing things like this. And graphically, I guess like the Spectrum version, it is okay when it's still, but obviously it moves very jerkily, and it's not joyful to play at all. And I think what happened in the 2008 version or 2010 version, they took like the original Street Fighter and they tried to put different sprites on it and get it.
I was going
to
say it looks a lot like Street Fighter rather than Street Fighter 2, whereas the Speccy version looks like Street Fighter 2, just doesn't play well.
Yeah, and I think that it's, again, a technical achievement that it's there. But then again, I mean, you know what? It's hard for me to kind of relate to, because I used to have an Amstrad and I adored it. But by this point, it was long gone.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that not everybody had access to a Super Nintendo or a Mega Drive, but God, like, play, you know, there's a reason why games like Manic Miner and stuff like that are still thought of today, and why when you talk about the Street Fighter version of Amstrad, you'd never play it apart from the novelty of that it existed.
You were perhaps a CPC owner during the yes. Halcyon days, right? So what are your alternatives to Street Fighter 2 on the Amstrad, given I'm extending this period ever so slightly here purely because the Amstrad owners who listen to Retro Asylum are probably our most passionate fans, so they want to hear some good stuff about the CPC. So what other good stuff was available on the CPC that is vaguely comparable to Street Fighter 2?
Now, bear in mind, there's a little bit of a caveat here. Some of the games I'm going to mention, I don't believe they're exclusives for the Amstrad. In fact, I know one of them, no, they're all not exclusives to the Amstrad.
Well, most of them weren't in the 8-bit computer.
Yeah, I was just about to say, most of them weren't. They were always dual platforms. So some of them will be better on the Commodore 64, some will be better on the Spectrum. But the first one I'm going to make a mention of is one of the very first one-on-one games I remember playing. And I love the soundtrack, even on the Amstrad. It's one of my favourite Amstrad games of all time, Barbarian. It's loads better on the Amiga. It's better on the Commodore 64 from what I can see now. But I didn't have access to one of those then. And this is the one where it was one-on-one. You were a warrior with a sword. And you actually, the guy on the front cover was Wolf from Gladiators.
Yeah.
And you could chop people's heads off, stuff like that. It was a really good game. And to the limitations of the 8-bit systems of the time, it worked really well. And the other one I'll offer up, which I personally think this game's amazing, but Arcade Plus, International Karate Plus, an amazing game. So much fun. I really wish I could have had an Amiga at the time, but I didn't. And this game was... The animation was excellent and the graphics were great for the Amstrad. The Amstrad suffered greatly from what I used to call stare effect as a kid, where arms looked like a pair, it looked like a stairs because it was so pixelated. But on this game, it looked really, really good. And another one I'd recommend, which is an arcade conversion, is Yar Kung Fu. I had loads of fun on that game. They pale in comparison to what Street Fighter 2 on the SNES is, but when it comes to the Amstrad, oh, yeah, the top one for me is definitely Barbarian. That's the one I've got the best memories of.
Great, okay. There you go, Amstrad fans. Don't say we don't ever give you some love. We've got a couple more to skim over very quickly. Let's have a quick chat about the C64 and Amiga versions, respectively.
Oh, okay. So you want to go for the C64
sure.
first, then?
Again, another miraculous happenstance it's even there, right?
I think so. I mean, the other thing I'd say about the C64 version is this is a departure from all the other versions because it's got a different palette and it's not actually used directly, the arcade sprites or anything like that as inspiration. They've not been drawn over. They've not been ported over. It's sprites that are made specifically for the C64 version. So I've only had a quick play of it, but I've had a look on it on YouTube as well to get a full viewpoint on it. And this looks like the best playing version of the 8-bit versions for sure.
Okay, that's very interesting. And the Amiga one I know is a very big bone of contention because should have the adequate hardware, depending on which Amiga you actually have. But generally speaking, it should be powerful enough to handle Street Fighter 2. So why does it get it so wrong?
Right, well, there's loads of different things. I can't wait. I've been waiting. This is what I've been waiting for over an hour now, to talk about the Amiga version.
Okay, here we go. We half our listeners. Oh God,
it pisses me off that this was an arcade conversion. US Gold should be absolutely frigging ashamed of themselves that they brought this out and they got people to pay money for it. I'll go through every single thing. What's wrong with this version? It's a bloody abomination. That's for a start. Bear in mind the SNES version was out this time. Bear in mind that, and the Amiga has some of the best games that have ever been created for the home market, especially in Europe. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, the Amiga! It was one of the things that I coveted as a child the most. I wanted an Amiga so much, and a 500, a 600, 1200, don't care. But the Street Fighter version of the US Gold version of Street Fighter 2 absolutely sucks and is an abomination. So you've got good sprites. Yeah, they look all right. They're a little bit washed out. Basically, it looks like as if they've ported them over, rinsed them in a washing machine, and said, oh, fuck it, that'll do. We'll put them in. Like, you know, there was no excuse why they couldn't have just redrawn the characters or drawn over them. Perhaps they probably did it that way to make sure it worked on all versions to help with the memory of it, perhaps. And then you've got Do you know what? There's one thing about the Amiga version that's better than all the versions that came out in the 16-bit era.
Okay.
And it's going to make you laugh, this is. This is something I was jealous of the Amiga version. It's got the proper introduction where they actually punch each other at the beginning.
Yeah.
Then it scrolls up to Street Fighter 2. But they can't even get that right. The music's wrong. How could they get the music wrong? All the music's wrong. It's so frustrating.
I think that's unforgivable. I do not understand because the Amiga is built on the reputation as being this musical powerhouse.
It was a musical powerhouse. For example, Pinball Fantasies. It's got some of the best music I've ever heard on a console. Absolutely amazing. Forget whether it's a computer console.
I know
of that
mean.
Era.
It's a great soundtrack.
Wonderful. Absolutely amazing. And then with the Amiga, you've got the... It's dead clunky and crap. And the C64 soundtrack. The C64 used to have a really great sound chip. It was amazing compared to like the Amstrad and the Speccy. Oh my God. But it's got this dead clunky. It's like, it's not even like a 1-1 ratio, copy. It's like they've re-recorded it. It's all dead clunky and crap. You need to just pause this for a second. Go and search for the Amiga version and hear the soundtrack. And also what they do, like they've got the character select music going on when you're fighting somebody. Then you go on the character select screen and Ryu's music's playing. Then you go to Ken's stage, and then Guile's music's playing. It's all jumbled up. It's so lazy. It all goes through all the US Gold versions. So the same thing happens on the C64, for example. So that's the biggest thing they got wrong, and it really annoys me. But then, let's just not forget about one of the biggest things that went wrong with the Amiga version. The frame rate is atrocious. You're looking at like 20 frames per second. That's less than 30, which makes it playable. It's 20 frames per second. Sometimes it's a bit less when it gets a little bit hectic, when you start doing fireballs and stuff like that. It's so inadequate. It is an impression of the game. It's like photographs of the game stuck together. And I don't mean just in terms of its frame rate, I just mean in just in terms of its execution. I looked into some research about this, and I'm sure there's some guys out there who'll be nodding their heads and thinking about this is one of the reasons why it was terrible. Apparently it was coded awfully behind the scenes. I don't know how that works. Like, I'm not a coder, but, you know, it was like as if it was two parts of one game put together, and that's why it's so clunky and horrible.
I think games from that day, if you look at stuff that US Gold had done in Ocean, were particularly notorious for this, whereby they were working to extremely tight deadlines, so they could never get a game as good as it should have been, because they were working on the deadlines that were completely unrealistic. So whether that was the case with Street Fighter 2 on the Amiga, I don't know. But it wouldn't surprise me, given that it's US Gold and they were churning out these type of games by the dozen.
So what you've got is something that, if you were to take a photograph and show your friend, you've got something that looks almost as good as the arcade. Let's forgive the fact that the palette's a little bit washed out, and there should be no reason why it is washed out. And then you hear the music, which is terrible, and the Amiga's got the best sound chip out of all these computers, what we've mentioned. It's got the best by far. And then you've got the terrible jerkiness and the fact that they didn't do an adequate system to play with a joystick. You know, imagine trying to play it with one button. And obviously you have to use the keyboard and the joystick to play it effectively, and that shouldn't really have been an option. You know, but then again, this is all about the era, really. Cut down games had cut down things from the hardware. There's nothing you could do about it, and it wasn't considered part of the lexicon of thought of these people that we thought, you know what, they can't actually get the full 6-button experience. And I guess the one reason why it's such a big bone of contention is it's such a missed opportunity. I'll kid you not, if you looked at screenshots of the Amiga version now while you're listening to this, you will think I'm talking out my behind. You'll think, this looks amazing. And it kind of does. Again, washed out palette. Rather bone of contention.
I've got a conspiracy for you. Let me know what you think about this one.
Okay.
They made a game that looked like Street Fighter 2.
Yes.
So it looked arcade perfect in magazines.
Yes, this is a good point.
So people go, Street Fighter 2 looks amazing on Amiga, I'm buying it, but then the game just doesn't play.
No, it plays awful. It really, really does. And you make a very good point, because I can remember seeing Street Fighter 2 on the Amiga, and I can remember being a bit upset, because I thought it looked a bit better than the SNES version. But then, of course, you actually get to see it, and I can remember my brother playing on it around his friend's house, who had an Amiga, and he says, he's got Street Fighter 2. I went, oh my God, I bet it's amazing on the Amiga, isn't it? He went, it's terrible. And I couldn't get my head around that. I was like, no, I think you're just saying that because we haven't got an Amiga. He goes, no, trust me, it's really awful. And I think in like test versions of the game, like betas that were submitted to the magazine, like M. Bison, the Dictator, was the wrong colour. Like his palette was wrong. These things are unforgivable. The source material is just like, was so vast. But I hear that, like, Capcom weren't that given with the game, but I can't see that being true when it was such a big license for them and they were producing it for so many different versions. I think it's just indicative of the time. This is how conversions were handled. They weren't handled in-house. They were outsourced out to person who could pay the most money and then churn them out. And you got very subpar versions. And I'm glad this isn't really part of it anymore, part of computing.
Yeah, this just wouldn't happen today.
No, not in the same respect.
Maybe
anyway.
I guess for a handheld.
I was about to say that. Maybe like a Game Boy Advance version or a 3DS version of some games. You know, they don't look quite as good. But, you know, they're a bit wiser now. They know that they have to get the mechanics right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and whilst we're on that point, let's talk about the Game Boy version. Because, again, shock horror that an 8-bit console has, an underpowered 8-bit console, that with a dot matrix monochrome screen, has a playable version of Street Fighter 2. And, again, I've never played this myself, but I've seen it on YouTube and it very pleasantly surprised me.
The thing is, though, with the Game Boy version, is you've always got the limitation of the screen. I've always found it strange that you'd want to play fighters on a handheld. I mean, I used to have a Neo Geo Pocket, for example, and they always look a bit strange because the sprites are a bit ski-whiff, and you can't always get the same purchase on your actual controller, and obviously you always have less buttons and that kind of thing. So I always think it's a bit of a missed opportunity playing it on a handheld. But going by the actual, graphically, what they pulled out of it, considering it's a dot matrix, it is kind of impressive. But I learnt by this point that when it came to handheld beat-em-up or arcade conversions, unless there was something very special and had reason to be on a handheld format, I avoided them like the plague. So therefore, Street Fighter 2, even though it would have been on my top of my list of one of the games to buy, is one that I avoided like the plague.
Fair enough. I think that rounds up what we want to discuss about home conversions. There is an Atari ST version I have zero experience with.
I was just about to say, I would like to just talk about it just ever so quickly.
Enlighten us if you've had experience of that one.
The Amiga version, but worse. There you
go. Isn't that the Atari ST in general?
Is it? Oh, do you know what? You shouldn't say that to people who like Atari STs, you know.
Oh, I know. Paul Monahan, one of our former hosts, is a big ST fan and he's going to be very angry with me for saying that.
Thing is, though, the Atari ST couldn't do games. They sucked at playing games with everything else they were great at. And the Atari ST version of the Street Fighter 2, I actually think it looks better than the Amiga version in terms of its graphics, because the palette isn't as washed out in certain areas. But, oh my God, it's like 8 frames per second when you're playing it. It's a disaster. It's a shame, but as you say, that's the same as like Final Fight on the Amiga or the ST. It's such a shame that they had such powerful computers and you had people basically bodging them together to make games. It's a travesty.
Mm, yeah, that's very, very unfortunate. There is one more that I want to touch on just very quickly before we round up this particular section of the podcast. And that's the 3DO one. And I want to talk about this one because not default Street Fighter 2. It's Street Fighter 2, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo X. And that's what makes it very special. It's arguably out of the early Street Fighter 2s, and not ones that came as compilations on more advanced consoles later on. But that initial 3DO release was a very special game, wasn't it?
Yeah, I loved it. I had a 3DO at the time, which I'm sure you're not shocked by. Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo on the 3DO was absolutely amazing. The graphics were great. The music was really, really good because it was rearranged versions of the soundtrack. Admittedly, I don't like the original Super Street Fighter 2 soundtracks. The unfortunate part for the people who live in the England like me was the fact that it was in PAL, but it was also letterboxed, so it actually only played in the centre of the screen, which was very frustrating. But apart from that, graphically excellent. It played great on the right pad, and I can remember being absolutely in love with it. And I can remember thinking, why do I like this so much more than Super Street Fighter 2 on the SNES? A lot of that came from the fact that it was presented a lot better, but Street Fighter 2 Turbo actually handles better than Super Street Fighter 2. I don't know whether that's an emotional reason or actually a factual mechanical reason. The only thing that lets down the 3DO version, to be very picky, apart from the letterboxing, which is, it isn't just being picky, that's a terrible issue, it shouldn't have happened for 50Hz users. It's the fact that the sprites are slightly smaller, and it means, for example, that some of the moves that you would do, some of the combo systems you do, they don't link up sometimes with certain characters 100%. But that's not something that you notice if you're playing the 3DO version like me 100% of the time and never really playing the arcade version. This this really should have shifted the 3DO and made it something better. But at this time, Street Fighter 2 was a game that people were moving away from. And as we were discovering more about 3D, we were moving into different fields completely. So sadly, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, as amazing as it was on the 3DO, wasn't as big as a draw as it could have been. It's such a shame.
If it had come out a year earlier, it might have saved the 3DO.
Yeah, I think that's a very big statement, but I think it's a very true one. You've got to think about what was around at the time. But the biggest thing that let down the 3DO, just to segue into that a little bit, is the fact that it was so expensive on launch. It just wasn't accessible. You think about a Super Nintendo at the time being £100, and it launching for less than £200, and then here we are, getting people to pay £400-£500 for a console. At the time, it's 1993-94. It's such a shame. But as an enduring memory, I can remember playing on Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo on the 3DO so much, and I can remember thinking, God, why couldn't this have come out earlier, because it's so awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's the debut of Gouki or Akuma in the home versions of Super Street Fighter 2, so it had its own unique thing there compared to all the other home versions, which arguably pushes it ever so slightly ahead, at least in terms of the Super Street Fighter 2 variants, maybe not the normal Street Fighter 2, but maybe that makes it the premiere version. Now, we're starting to come towards the end of the podcast, but there is one more very crucial topic that we have to discuss. It's not necessarily related directly to Street Fighter 2, but it's the influence that it had on other games. Now, it was a very successful formula. It took the world a little bit by surprise, and it made Capcom literally billions.
Yes.
So everyone wanted a piece of the pie, and a lot of clones or tribute games, I don't know if you want to call them that, competitors, let's say. A new challenger has arrived. And if we start with SNK, because that's where the story gets very interesting. We spoke about the two producers of the original Street Fighter. They made that game and then moved to SNK. And they were making what they considered to be the genuine sequel to Street Fighter. And they came up with Garouden Setsu, or Fatal Fury. And a very good game in its own right. Differs slightly from Street Fighter 2 in regards that it has that foreground background combat system, so it adds something
system,
a little bit new there. But generally speaking, it's a very similar game. But what's your thoughts on Fatal Fury overall?
The Fatal Fury series is something that you've got to take on because it's just one of the biggest releases in fighting history. I don't think Fatal Fury 1 is that great. I think that actually, in some ways, it had better art in terms of its achievement. I'm not saying that like Duck King's a better character than, say, I don't know, Ken or whatever, but I think a lot of the art was really good and the sound was good as well. There's a lot of real good samples in there. So, you know, it's worthy of its place in history, but I think overall the game is nowhere near as good as Street Fighter 2. And I think that's based on the fact that the emotional connection that you have with the game and how well we got to know it. But it's also the fact that, like, for some daft reason, they could have changed this so easily, but like, you had a single player mode where you could only play as three characters.
Yeah.
That was a massive mess up on their part.
Yes, it was. I mean, they were good characters. Terry, Andy, and Joe were all very good in their own right. And certainly an improvement on Street Fighter, where you could only play as Ryu. But given that this came out 9 months after Street Fighter 2, they've technically limited themselves down immediately. So it can never be as good as Street Fighter 2, although they changed that later with Garouden Setsu Special and the direct sequel as well, which opens up more of the characters.
And just one thing that I didn't like about Fatal Fury was the combo system wasn't as fluid or as interesting as Street Fighter. It feels, if you play Fatal Fury the first one now, compared to like Street Fighter 2, it does feel very clunky indeed in certain areas.
Fair enough. What about Art of Fighting? It's a game I'm a big fan of.
I really like Art of Fighting for some reason, because it's got the same letdown from Fatal Fury. There's only two playable characters in the first instance.
Ryo versus Robert.
Oh yeah, and those awful announcers. And on this one, it was trying to be more like Street Fighter. It had more of a groove to it that was more akin to Street Fighter, like the story mode and all that kind of thing. And the one thing they always tried to improve on SNK, and this is where they kind of got it wrong, is that they always try to make the graphics better. And undoubtedly, at the time, these graphics are much, much better than Street Fighter 2, and the characters are way bigger and more detailed. But it was a bit floaty, wasn't it? That's the main big thing I take from Art of Fighting. I enjoyed playing it, and I enjoyed trying to get fear in it, but the characters, they used to float about a bit, and they used to make that really like strange noise when they hit each other, like pew, pew, pew. I can't even do an impression of it. It's a ridiculous thing to do, isn't it? But there's a really tacky noise they make when they hit each other, which kind of makes it less immersive, in my opinion. So overall, I like the character arc and who the people were. I certainly think the art and all that and the characters were way better than what Street Fighter did in terms of technical accomplishment, but overall they still couldn't get it right. They still couldn't beat Street Fighter in terms of its mechanics.
I'm sure they don't feel good now, but at the time I really liked Art of Fighting. But it's an interesting affair there between what SNK was at the beginning, which was the old Street Fighter team, versus the new Street Fighter team, because you have Ryo, who is a blatant rip-off of Ryu.
And Ken. He's like,
and Ken, he's kind of like a merger.
He's even got an orange suit
between the two. So, of course, Capcom answered back in later versions of Street Fighter. I think it was in Alpha. They introduced the character Dan, who is a direct copy of Ryo. So we were getting a little bit meta at this point. But they're basically saying, if you're going to do it, we're going to do it. And they made Dan, who was an absolutely abysmal character, just to really throw it down their throats.
Yeah, and he had a pink suit. And instead of doing what Ryo in Hard Fighting, which is a Hoken, which is very similar to Hadouken, I'm sure you can see.
Hoken?
He did, yeah, Dan would do Kuroken. What did he do now? He's used to say something else. Kuroken or something like that. No, that's bloody Chun-Li, isn't it? Either way, he did something that was a complete rip-off.
He did that and move of course, that sounded... It was a bit like the Tatsumaki Senpukyaku, but he just used to go, Dan's here! Dan's here! And then they answer back. No, we're getting into a bit of a feud here because SNK then in later iterations of the King of Fighters series, which is another classic, they introduced the character Shingo Yabuki, who is a copy of Dan.
Yeah, and he's also a palette. He's a head swap, which is what basically SNK were accusing Capcom of doing. They were like saying, oh, we don't do head swaps here at SNK, but Cat can't do head swaps. And Shingo is a head swap of Kyo, who's a really good character on King of Fighters.
Yeah, but he doesn't have projectiles. He's kind of like a watered-down version of Kyo, but he has very powerful melee moves.
Yeah, and then it turns out Dan actually became a playable character in later versions, actually became decent enough to use.
Yeah, they all eventually evolve into genuine characters, but their first iterations are literally taking the piss out of Capcom and SNK respectively. So that was very funny. We're just going to very, very briefly skim over some of the other ones now. So if you keep your retort a little bit brief on these, Matt. World Heroes.
Well, it was a game that I liked the look of in the arcades. Artistically, it really popped out. Very colourful. A lot of the characters are very strange, including Rasputin and his stupid laugh he used to do. This is one achievement they made with Weird World Heroes, is that they got the slickness and the fluidity of Street Fighter correct on this one, but the actual game sucks. It's not very enduring. It's not a game that you'd revisit now based on its own merit, in my humble opinion. And all the characters are a cack.
Yeah, I agree. Very colourful. Very novel, and definitely going to keep you occupied for a little while, but ultimately doesn't lack the finesse of Street Fighter. And if we just mention briefly King of Fighters series, which I'm a massive fan of, as an extension of Fatal Fury, because of course they were running side by side at one point with the Real Bout series, but eventually King of Fighters just sort of took over, didn't it?
King of Fighters is excellent. It's a really good fighter. It's probably one of the only fighters that you should look at if you're not looking at Street Fighter 2. It's very accomplished. You've got all the fighters that come from Art of Fighting and Fatal Fury, for example. You bring them all together. You make them play a lot better. The fluidity of this game is excellent. The combo system works really well, and the super moves are really memorable, and the way that you execute them is excellent as well. I think at the time, especially King of Fighters 95, 96 especially, they were much better than what Capcom are putting out. They were King of Fighters 95 especially was a massive, massive plus compared to what Capcom were doing at the time. Even though I love Street Fighter Alpha, Street Fighter Alpha became amazing when Street Fighter Alpha 3 came out, in my opinion.
Sure, okay, that's a fair enough one. And last one we'll mention, just whilst we're talking about Neo Geo hardware, let's give some love to Samurai Showdown.
One of the most expensive games I've ever bought. It was one of the most exciting games I've ever got bought. Massive big characters like we were used to from
sprites
SNK at the time. Sprites are huge with the sprite scaling effect that was also in Art of Fighting, but done even better. Great backgrounds, good music, excellent character designs that were very, very enduring because they went on to have lots and lots of sequels. It included swords, which made things a lot more interesting. And the main thing about this was the sonic element to this. The music was excellent, and also this is clunky, but it didn't feel clunky because obviously swords were involved, and it was a good game to play. And at my time, it was my favourite SNK game, and I loved having it in the home, and it makes me think back to having World Heroes 2 at home, which I couldn't stand. Samurai Showdown has a very unique charm to it that I'm glad that I got to be part of.
Yeah, it's a beautiful game, beautiful series in general. Beautiful. Let's talk about some of the ones outside of Neo Geo then, and we can't talk about Street Fighter competitors without mentioning Mortal Kombat and what a big deal that was. Now, this is the West's answer to the beat-em-up craze, and we definitely take a different stance on how to do a beat-em-up in the West than they do in Japan. It's less technical, but visually more impressive.
Well, I mean, it's visually more impressive at the time, isn't it? I mean, you used to see Mortal Kombat in the arcade. It was absolutely stunning, from what I can remember.
Yes, it was. And you throw the whole gore factor in there, which was a novelty at this point, realistically speaking. I mean, you get a little bit of bored getting spat when someone cuts someone in the face, but Mortal Kombat was a gore fest. The fatality issue rears its ugly head constantly in terms of game censorship. But it's made a lasting cultural impact that's almost akin to that Street Fighter 2. In fact, it's probably the one that took advantage of the Street Fighter 2 craze better than anyone.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because it took it and then also put it onto a next level by adding that gore element and getting us all talking about fatalities in the playground and how to do them. It made it certainly a very special game. Mortal Kombat 2 was great, and I much preferred that to Super Street Fighter 2 for some reason. I played Mortal Kombat 2 a lot more, but if I had to reflect back on the series, at the time, it kind of peaks very high and then goes down low. Mortal Kombat's gone on to have a really good legacy. You know, we've got Mortal Kombat 10, which I haven't played at length, but it's a decent fighter, and it's certainly one of the better ones out there right now. But in retrospect, Mortal Kombat 1, 2, and 3, they're all crap compared to Street Fighter 2. It's very interesting how, in retrospect, I would go out my way to play Street Fighter 2, but I wouldn't Mortal Kombat. It's just not as good. It was very novel at the time, and it's a shame that at the time I believed it was better. I almost feel guilty.
Fair enough. I don't think I need to add anything further to that one. I'm going to run two more by you because they're culturally relevant to the whole narrative that we've been discussing. Now, the Mega Drive was searching for a Street Fighter 2 before they got theirs, and Sega delivered Eternal Champions, which I laughed my ass off as a Super Nintendo owner back in the day. This game is so stupid. You can tell it's been made by people who don't know anything about the genre whatsoever.
One of the things I remember about this the most is something that was mentioned in the instruction manual. It said that time was like a stream. No matter what you did to manipulate the stream would always flow forwards. And it was something that I quoted in my end of year test, and people thought it was amazing, but I'd nicked it from a game manual. Anyway, the actual game itself was very much built up, and it had months and months of build up and things like Mean Machines. Julian Rignall, known as Jazz at the time, he famously went onto Gamesmaster, sorry, I'm getting really angry now, and said, "Oh, I'm not going to say it's better than Street Fighter 2, but it's as good as." Julian Rignall, I follow you on Twitter. Come on, you were talking shit. This game is absolutely terrible. The characters are awful. The concept of them being like Time Lords and shifting around in time sucks balls. And the fact that you had characters who, one of them looked like a big character, like, he looked like, what's his name? The one with the LaForge from Star Trek?
Troy LaForge. Troy
LaForge, the one with the, except he was really built up, and he looked like he was going to be a disco dancer more than a bloody Star Trek member. And then you had players like this Lizard Man from bloody, the Merman, should I say, from Atlantis, and then this guy called Tyler, who was from the 30s, he was a detective. So, actually, they've done quite well for me to remember all these things, but the reason I remember it is because I was so disappointed when I played it. The sound is awful. It's absolutely terrible. It uses all the American Genesis sound set, which, if anybody's out there is a little bit of an expert or a fan of like the Genesis and the Mega Drive, you'll know that the American Mega Drive stuff just had terrible sound sets. This was no exception. The sprites look good, I suppose, in terms of their size and how they looked on the screen, but the overall game was very, very clunky. And to say it is as good as Street Fighter 2, that is an abomination. I really wish I could be angry.
I bet you any money that there's Mega Drive owners who are listening to this right now are still saying it was as good as Street Fighter 2, because that's all they had. They're clinging to it desperately. Let it go.
It's not, the characters are terrible. They've got good backstories, admittedly, but they're very tired. It's very obvious they had to make a Street Fighter 2 and not make anybody look like they were from Street Fighter 2.
Last one we're going to talk about as far as the immediate clones went, and we talked about the Amiga one being bad, and the Amiga was desperate for a good beat 'em up, so they got Body Blows.
Okay, so if you think Hawkins by Ryo and Art of Fighting is bad, and also that Data East were bad for their mockery of Street Fighter 2, Body Blow had guys that did Harukans.
This game,
yeah.
Were they speaking English?
I don't know. I don't know if that's the case. But he had like some kind of cool character who had like a denim jacket on and denim jeans. He's like, hey, yeah. I don't remember what the character's name's called. But this one actually did very well. It sold well by System 17. Because obviously the Amiga didn't have anything that was like Street Fighter 2. And the version of Street Fighter 2 they had was basically a JPEG on a disc. So, you know.
That's amazing.
And so Body Blows actually was playable. And what System 17 did is actually look at what the Amiga did and said, how can we make this into a one-on-one game? And they also did something like Body Blows Galactic. They followed it up with another version. And I'm sorry for those guys out there who are Amiga players. I just apologize. I don't remember the actual terminology that was used for the second version. So it went on to do okay. But, you know, on the whole, having played it now, it's not very good at all. It's like a Fisher-Price toy version of a fighter. My first beat 'em up. That's exactly what sums up Body Blows. But luckily for them, it did well at the time. And there's a reason why we don't talk about Body Blows anymore.
I think that's almost a wrap for the show. We've covered so much, and it was so much fun discussing this with you, Matt. I hope you've enjoyed it as well. There's just one more thing I want to touch upon before we wrap up. And I want to ask you, in Street Fighter 2, and you can do it through the extended Street Fighter 2, so up to like Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo and that. Who's your favourite character? What's your favourite version? And what's your favourite piece of music?
Okay, so out of all my versions, I think in this one especially, I'd have to say my favourite character is Akuma. I think my favourite character is Ryu because of his story and how much I've identified with the character. And my favourite piece of music is Ryu's music. It's the one that I remember the most, and it's the one I feel the most attached to. Ryu's just amazing. I just wanted to be him as a kid. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. He's an upstanding role model.
Yes, the vagabond who fell off the earth.
Yes, he certainly was. And with that, that's my final say on the Street Fighter 2 version. Oh, the version I like the most. I'm going to have to say Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo in terms of its overall play. It's the most enduring version that will last. But the one that I had the most fun with and played the most was the original Street Fighter 2. I've got a copy of it in near perfect condition, sealed up, that's never going to get played. It's the one that I feel the closest to. I've got amazing memories of it because of me and my brother going and getting it down that town, like I explained to you earlier in this podcast. It's the one I feel the closest to. And at this point, I've just got to just say that it's been a true honour and a pleasure to be part of the Retro Asylum podcast. Thanks so much for inviting me on.
I don't think I could have had a better guest to do this with, Anna. Thank you for taking the time to come and visit us for this one. Hopefully we can get you on again for a later one, because I'm sure there's more fighting game pizzazz that you want to express, no doubt, that we didn't have time for this evening. But as is a custom on the Retro Asylum podcast, when we have a guest on, we like to allow them to choose the music that we're going to outro to. So have you got a piece in mind that you'd like to finish off the show?
I definitely do, and I don't think this is going to be any kind of surprise to people that this is the version I've gone for. I'm going to get you to play out Ryu's theme, but this is played on piano and violin by Ben Chan and Laura. And to obviously give them full credit, it's a Ben Chan violin is the YouTube channel. Laura's on the piano playing the backing music, and the lead instrument is the violin. It's a beautiful piece of music.
Yes, it is, Marisha. It's a beautiful piece of music. And one of the reasons why this is quite poignant is that Yoko Shinomura, she actually left Capcom in 93 to go and work on more orchestral style of music. She wanted to get away from this electronic rock stuff that she'd perhaps done in more of in Street Fighter 2 and went to do more orchestral pieces for JRPGs. So the fact that we've got an orchestral version of a classic rock riff for Street Fighter 2 is a perfect way to play out on. So guys, sit back and enjoy. Thank you for joining the show at Retro Asylum again, and we'll see you soon for another episode. Thanks a lot, guys.